Oh, that was some hillbilly gospel music. Hello, this is William Fink, and this is the Christogene European Fellowship Forum. It is Thursday, February 17th, 2011. I'd like to first say that I don't know if he's emailed anybody yet, but Danny, he comes here quite often. Danny from Northern Ireland, he had his operation yesterday, and he had some utensils removed from his spine from an accident he had a long time ago, and he wrote me last night and said that everything was fine, and he was in his hospital bed with his laptop and doing quite well. So I guess he's on the road to recuperation, we pray. I have a letter from Dorcas that she only mailed me a month ago, and I finally got around to reading it. I apologize. I'm always behind. And she wanted to know about Cain and in relation to Genesis 4:7, where it says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? Yet, you know, all I'm going to say is that Yahweh constantly challenged his enemies to do well. You know, even when we see the Pharisees approach John the Baptist and inquire as to who gave him the authority to baptize, he called them a race of vipers, but then he said that they should do works worthy of the kingdom of God, and prove that they, if they had good fruit, which of course we know they don't have good fruit, they can't possibly produce good fruit because they're evil. In the Acts, Paul challenges Herod, and it's a rhetorical question, and it's lost in the King James Version of the Bible, but Paul basically, at the end of, in the closing chapters of Acts, challenges Herod to believe the gospel. And of course we know that Herod can't believe the gospel. He's a viper, and wolves can't be sheep. But that challenge is all throughout Scripture, where Yahweh challenges his enemies to do good, and he knows that they can't do good. They can't possibly do good because they're bastards. And that's a lesson, not for them, that's a lesson for us. It's a lesson for us that these evil, wicked people who were created in the very violation of the laws of God, that they can't possibly do good. And that's an important lesson that, sadly, most of our people will never learn because they just haven't been taught and they haven't read their Bibles for themselves. That's the shame of it. But a bad tree can't possibly produce good fruit. And that's our lesson to learn. It's not the enemies of God. It's not their lesson to learn. He challenges them on behalf of us so that we see that they can't possibly do good. That's the way I see that. Now, Dorcas also wanted to know about the statement of Christ where he said that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And Christ goes on to explain that all things are possible with God. And that's the part that everybody misses. Men want to keep on redefining what the camel is. Men want to keep on redefining what the eye of a needle is. And they make up stories. They try to change the eye of the needle through the nighttime gate of the city. Now, you know, I've read a lot of classics. I've read an awful lot, and I've never seen that description anywhere in any of the books I've read. And, you know, when you're reading about the histories of wars and sieges, those gates are pretty important. I don't think that that so many historians would have left out such a description as the nighttime gate of a city being called the eye of a needle. That story's been invented by Christian Identity or by modern Christians, and I've never seen it. People are trying to redefine the Word of God. And Dorcas illustrated to me that somebody redefined the camel to mean a rope. And again, people are trying to redefine the Word of God. The idea of Christ saying that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a man to enter the kingdom of heaven is basically, and he meant exactly what he said. It is, the camel is a camel, and the eye of a needle is the eye of a needle. The Greeks did use metal needles with small eyelets in them so that they could thread the needle and sew That's a very old art. So Christ knew what he was talking about, and the King James translators knew what they were translating. The idea is that it's impossible for a man to determine who can enter the kingdom of heaven. It's that simple. And why do men want to keep changing that verse? I'll tell you why men want to keep changing that verse. Because men have this worldly desire to know now or to decide for themselves who is going to enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, guess what? It's not possible for a man to determine that. Only Yahweh has determined that. Now, he's told us who's going to be in that kingdom of heaven, and men don't understand that. If you don't have this Christian identity message, if you don't have the understanding of the covenant promises, then you're going to try to seek to change the statement that Christ made concerning the camel and the eye of the needle. What Christ is telling us is that only God can determine who enters the kingdom of heaven. That's all he's telling us. Okay, if this is an open forum, that's my opening remarks. I know that Tia Teffy wanted to talk about Isaiah chapter 19, but we could do that later. I just wanted to address those two things from Dorcas, because she's been quite patient in waiting for an answer to her query. And I'm a bum. I hardly read my electronic email, even though I sit here all day. It's impossible to keep up with. And printed mail is it's very nice to receive letters from wonderful people, but it's almost impossible for me to get to an answer. It's just a huge time-consuming restriction. I can't help it. Okay, I'm going to unmute some people here, and I'll unmute Dorcas first, hello, Dorcas.
Hello. Thank you very much for your reply. I realize that you're a very busy man, so I quite understand.
Yeah, well, I'm not trying to complain. It's just the way it is.
So, you know, sometimes things stay with you, and you've got to spell them out to somebody, and then... it sort of puts it in its place, really. I mean, it's amazing how people come out with these things. I've actually seen that little door in Jerusalem, and they called that the Eye of the Needle. It's just like it's in a massive door, and it's a little tiny door right at the bottom of it.
Well, that's nice, but I've never read about such a door being called the Eye of the Needle in the classics or in Josephus or in any other ancient book, right?
No.
And maybe they built that door later and called it that after the gospel.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? I mean, that's a possibility. Yeah. But I have no... I would like to see a record of that which predates the gospel, and I haven't found one.
No.
I'm not saying I haven't read everything either, right? I mean, I still have a lot of books to read that I would like to anyway, but it's I've never seen it, and the people that make the claim for it, from them, I haven't seen an ancient citation.
Right. I think I found a way out of it. Sorry, I thought I'd lost you. No, sorry.
Anyway, I would say until I see an ancient citation, I have to accept that Christ meant literally exactly what he said. And even so, it's up to God to determine who's going to enter the kingdom of heaven and not up to men. Men want to redefine what Christ said so that they could squeeze in and imagine that they could determine who belongs in the kingdom. Aside from the Word of God. The Word of God is very clear.
Yes, absolutely. We take upon ourselves things that really we know nothing about.
Mm. Yeah, there's only one door, and there's no back door.
Right.
No, how true.
So what else do Tia wanted to discuss? To discuss Isaiah 19, Burden of Egypt, Behold, the Lord rides upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother and every one against his neighbor, city against city and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fall in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the counsel thereof, and they shall seek to the idols and to the charmers and to them that have familiar spirits and to the wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over to the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith Yahweh of hosts. And the waters shall fail from the sea, and the rivers shall be wasted and dried up. Well, all this has happened to Egypt very, very long ago. And where we see Egypt, we should think Mitzrayim, because that's what it's talking about. And I don't think Mitzrayim has been in Egypt in many thousands of years now. And they shall turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up, and the reeds and flags shall wither. And the paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. The fishers shall also mourn, and all they that cast angle into the brooks, the fishermen, shall lament, and they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Moreover, they that work in fine flax and they that weave networks shall be confounded, and they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fish. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools. The counsel of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. How say ye unto the Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? Where are they? Where are the, thy wise men? And let them tell thee now, and let them know what Yahweh of hosts has purposed upon Egypt. Now, this, when Isaiah is writing this, this is just before the time when the Nubians overran Egypt. And that Nubian blood was never really removed from Egypt. And it was a long process for all of the people of Egypt to be consumed by it. But eventually the people of Egypt were consumed by the Nubian blood. And later on by the that they were marginalized by the Greeks. And later on, of course, Egypt became an Arab state. Well, yeah. Let me continue reading from verse 14 in Isaiah 19. Yahweh has mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggers in his vomit. That was a judgment from God and a trial from God upon Egypt. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt which the head or the tail, branch or rush may do. In that day Egypt shall be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of Yahweh of hosts, which he shakes over it. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Everyone that makes mention thereof shall be afraid in himself because of the counsel of Yahweh of hosts, which he has determined against it. In that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to Yahweh of hosts. One city shall be called the city of destruction. And I would think that kind of fit Alexandria and the men of Judah that terrorized Egypt were probably, to a great extent, the Macedonians. In that day there shall be an altar to Yahweh in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord, or to Yahweh. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto Yahweh of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they shall cry unto Yahweh because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And Yahweh shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know Yahweh in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblations. There they shall vow a vow unto Yahweh and perform it, and Yahweh shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it, and they shall return even to Yahweh, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them. He can't possibly be talking about these people today that call themselves Egyptians just because they're inhabiting a land that we call Egypt. They are not Mitzrayim.
That's right.
Mitzrayim is a tribe, not a place. So this, I think, has to be talking about something that's yet in the future. And a lot of people want to say that, and let me continue reading first. And Yahweh of hosts shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it, and they shall return even to Yahweh, and he shall be entreated of them, and shall heal them. In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom Yahweh of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel my inheritance. A lot of people want to say this happened already. This could not have happened already. I'll explain why. Yes, the Assyrians went into Egypt and subdued and subjected and conquered it and made it pay tribute. But at that time also, the Israelites had been subdued and conquered by the Assyrians, and they were all deported. Was Israel and Egypt and Assyria a third as peers or equals at that time? No, because Assyria subjected and subdued Israel and Egypt and ruled over and oppressed them until the time when the Scythian Israelites destroyed Assyria. So this can't possibly describe the events of the 7th century B.C. Now, can this describe later events? I don't. Yeah, you know, the blood of Egypt had pretty much been subsumed by Nubians and Negroes by the time that the Parthians, who were Israelites, had taken command and ruled over the peoples of Mesopotamia, which would have included any remnant of the Assyrian. And by the time of the Parthians, the Macedonians ruled Egypt. So you can't say that Mitzrayim was a third at this time, because Mitzrayim was for the most part gone at this time. And whatever remnant of Mitzrayim was left, if any, they were simply slaves of the Macedonians. And whatever remnant of the Assyrians were around at the time of Christ, and I'm sure there were probably some, but they were virtual slaves of the Parthians. So I don't think that there's any fulfillment of this way it states in ancient times. We have to remember that first, Christ says that the men of Nineveh, and they're the Assyrians, will be in the resurrection. And they will be in the resurrection. And then he says that the queen of the south, who's from Cush, right, but she's a white Cushite, she will be in the resurrection. And we have to assume also that the Mizraimites, the real men of Mizraim, they will be in the resurrection too. All of the Adamic race will be in the resurrection, because they all have that they all have to have that opportunity to grasp the tree of life, which they're promised in Genesis 3:23. I sincerely believe that this is yet to be fulfilled, and even though Israel, as Judith was concerned, Israel does have that covenant relationship with God and a special relationship that the rest of our race does not have. But that doesn't mean that they won't be in the resurrection. Every Adamic spirit will be in the resurrection. Yeah. Every single Adamic spirit will be in the resurrection. Israel has a special covenant relationship with God. The city of God is for the children of Israel. Yeah. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
But it's by that matter, are all the Genesis 10 nations blessed in Abraham's seed?
Will that be the first resurrection?
There is no second resurrection. That's Revelation chapter 20 is severely misunderstood. There are pieces of scripture in Revelation chapter 20 that do not belong in the scripture, because they derived from the commentary of Andreas of Caesarea. And where it says the first resurrection, that is not in the original manuscripts, in any of the original manuscripts. That is part of the commentary of Andreas of Caesarea that made its way into scripture in the 9th century, 8th or 9th century AD, and from there it ended up in the Textus Receptus. But it's not part of scripture. Revelation chapter 5.
Not 19.
Chapter 20, verse 5, should be 5 words. That's all it should be. It should say, this is the first restoration, period. That's all it should say.
Yeah.
Where it says that the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. That is not a part of any of the original manuscripts. That comes from the commentary of Andreas of Caesarea.
Wow.
Which made its way into the text of the copy of Revelation that ultimately was used by the King James translators.
Wow.
And that's very well established in the 27th edition of the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Graecae.
Wow, that is quite eye-opening to me, because not only were we taught, you know, to be in the first resurrection was what we were aiming for, and then the rest would come up in the second, and then and they would live 100 years, an old man would reach 100, you know, and a baby, so they would have their chance to have everlasting life.
Well, every soul, every spirit that comes from Yahweh has everlasting life. I'm sorry, we already have it. And that's something we don't understand. It's read the last 19 chapters of Isaiah.
Well, thank you for that.
I will prove when I do my Revelation program on chapter 20 that it's already happened in the past.
Yes.
I already did a program with Clifton back 2 years ago, and I won't build too much more upon that. But if Christ is to reign 1,000 years in our future, first it says that Gog and Magog will go out to deceive the nations in Revelation chapter 20, verse 8. Okay? Yeah. If that's not what's going on right now, then I'm going to take all my Bibles and throw them in the garbage. Okay? And if Christ destroys Gog and Magog at his return, and they live to come back and torment us after 1,000 years, again, I'm going to take all my Bibles and throw them in the garbage.
Yeah.
Gog and Magog are already revived. They were revived that they crawled out of the pit between the time of the De Medici popes and the French Revolution. From the time of the French Revolution, Gog and Magog, the Edomite Jews, they have been, Gog, the Edomite Jews, the devil, Satan, made it out of the pit with the French Revolution, and he's gathered the armies of Gog and Magog against the children of Israel ever since. This has all been going on. It's right in front of our faces. And all the nations are deceived. I, Gog, for the last 200 years.
Years, yeah.
This has all been going on right in front of our faces, and nobody recognizes it.
And everyone has their own interpretation of it as well.
Well, the first restoration, as my translation reads it, okay? And that's what the word means. It means restoration. That first restoration, what was the feudal period in Europe, where the children of God were, there were always Jews around, but they didn't rule over us. Satan never ruled over us. Our own kings ruled over us, and they were free, virtually free from satanic influences and from the Edomite Jews. There was no usury in Europe, which is very important, because it's usury that always enslaves us. And the feudal system gets a lot of bad press from the Jewish capitalists, but the feudal system was a pretty damn good system, because men could live and rely on their God for the fruits of the land, And not rely on a Jew for his phony money.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, well, it's wonderful. Yes. I can't understand how anyone can come to the truth of these things just by reading their Bible. I mean, we've been taken down so many roads.
Yep.
Well, who listened to my Revelation 8 chapters?
I did.
Yes.
And I was particularly interested in, when you mentioned in verse 12 of Revelation 8, which was the fourth angel, I hadn't seen that before. And you mentioned some sort of cosmic event in 536 AD, round about then. Well, that rang a bell, because I remember reading about devastation in our area of the world as well. And many, many people died because of the lack of food. And so I looked this up on the internet, and there was quite a bit on this subject. So it seems to have been worldwide.
Well, yes, and it did cause a famine. And I think that it was a significant event that is recorded in history. Procopius describes it very well. But when we nail that event about a third part of the sun being smitten and a third part of the moon, and we see that that's 537 A.D., that actually happened, and when we look at these events in the Revelation, which are said to have happened just before and just after, that is, to me, it's a sure nail that fastens the entire interpretation of the Revelation to that time, that it nails the interpretation.
Yes, it does it superbly.
And, oh, you didn't see any of that from anybody else in Identity. I don't think it's been written about before.
No, it just slotted into place for me, and I thought, you know, it's the first time I'd seen that. But then so many other things did, you know, when I started looking. And that was known as Justinian's Plague, wasn't it? Isn't that what Procopius called it?
I don't know I don't think he used those exact words, but he did say that it happened in the 10th year of Justinian.
Yeah.
And that's, I really believe that nails that, that the sun and the moon darkening nails that star fallen from heaven to Justinian, and that's who it's describing. It's the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. You know, Justinian's decision to regain Italy and northern Africa for the empire basically made the world safe for Catholicism, which Justinian also initiated when he gave the Bishop of Rome the power over the dominion over all the other bishops of Christendom. And that was Justinian. He began that temporal power of the papacy, and he made sure that the Roman bishop would have hegemony over Christendom, and that set up that set the stage for the papacy.
Mm. Oh.
And that's that. They were world changing events, because what we see for the next 1,200 years in the history of the papacy, and that's definitely the little horn. A perfect description of the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. Excuse me. And I'll be getting into that when I do the my interpretation, my program for Revelation chapter 13. I'll be getting into Daniel 7 at length. My Friday program will be all about Revelation chapters 10 and 11. And the Reformation is going to be the major topic there, because that's what it's describing. Well, which are the next events in world history? The next major events affecting Europe in world history after the invasions of the Arabs and the Turks, which is described in Revelation 9, is the Reformation. And Rand and Compere also said that. But I think that I basically have further information and I can more... I think I could better describe the consequences if there was no Reformation. I hope to anyway, okay. Tomorrow night.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got about 12 pages written on it.
Well, that should be good. So we'll be covering the two olive trees and...
Yes, that's Israel and Judah. The two witnesses are Israel and Judah. Their witness, their testimony is that they became Christians. That's all they needed to do to fulfill that testimony, was to become Christians. They proved that the people that became Christian, but right there, they proved that they were the children of God. The people who would break from the Catholics for the Word of God to follow their Bibles, that's the testimony. They proved that they're the children of God.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are still waiting for two witnesses.
Well, they've been here all along.
Yeah, that'll take a long time.
Dear.
Now, Compere said that the 3.5 days was the Fifth Lateran Council, and he was right, and I agree with him, but I agree with him not totally, because his description of it was just all wrong. But I'm going to describe it much better tomorrow, I think, and explain why with the Fifth Lateran Council, children of Israel lay dead, I think the children of Judah, right, lay dead in the street for 3.5 days during the Fifth Lateran Council. Now, where Comparé fell short is that that's only one witness. Second witness is the 3.5-year terror of Bloody Mary that happened 40 years later. That's the second witness. Where all England rejoiced when Bloody Mary ascended to the throne. That's the people, and Italy rejoiced too when several of the cardinals who were reformers had actually betrayed their cause and came back to the fold. Rome celebrated. Thousands of people turned up in Rome to.
Wow.
In order to witness that, and that's the fulfillment of the description of the people celebrating in the streets over the death of the two witnesses, because if the Reformation fails, then the two witnesses are indeed dead.
Yes. Wow.
Because Israel and Judah stay under the rule of the popes, and the pope. Yes. Was a Jew. The Pope, the Fifth Lateran Council, was, first it was Julius II, right? I don't know what his bloodline was. I don't care. He called the council, but he died 2 months into it, into a 5-year council. He was replaced by Leo X. Leo X was a de Medici. He was a Jew.
Oh, yeah.
But with all certainty. The word of God under the Fifth Lateran Council was virtually banned, because one of the decrees of the Fifth Lateran Council was that bishops had to approve any book that was going to be printed in their diocese. And since the Bible had already been banned from the hands of the people, that would have banned the Bible if it weren't for Martin Luther setting off the Reformation by nailing his theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg.
Okay.
So, all these things fall right into place. Perfect.
They do. I think, all the teaching that I've been taught, people try and spiritualize so much scripture, and that's, and all these odd stories come about, whereas the history is logical. Just understanding the symbols, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely logical. People try to spiritualize things when they don't understand them, because they haven't read a book.
Mm. And that's why it's been so important to downgrade history in schools, isn't it? To make sure people don't know where they came from or what happened.
That's true.
Well, without history, everything's fuzzy, and you could be like Eli James. You could shoot from the hip and say anything about any verse at the time that you feel like saying, just to make it fit your agenda.
Yes.
And that's what they do. That's what they all do.
No wonder there's that scripture that says even the elect can be deceived.
Certainly. Yeah, that is true.
Well, I'm going to post my notes probably tonight on Christreich for my commentary for Revelation 10 and 11, if you want to sneak.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Like a sneak preview.
24 hours or so.
I have got the book, Comparé's Revelation book, with your and Clifton's notes, so I've got it.
Right, but I haven't even used that for this. For any of this? No, I haven't even referred to it. I really haven't.
Right. Did you say it was on Christreich?
Oh, yeah, Christreich. Well, all the notes are going to be on Christogenia after each program, right? But I've been putting just the notes that consist of the commentary for the verses, I've been putting on Christreich chapter by chapter.
Right.
And as I go into the future, That's wherever I amend my Revelation commentary or add to it or correct it or whatever I'm able to do, it's going to be on Christreich.
Okay.
That's the official home of my commentary on the Revelation.
So it's all in one place. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's worthy of being in a separate place, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Since it's really a subdomain of Christogenia, I still get the Google numbers, so I don't have to have all my stuff on one site.
Yeah, that's best. Yeah.
Mm. But yeah, I've come a long way since those notes for that I did for Clifton 10 years ago, almost. I don't know. Seven years ago. It's been a while.
Yes. It's very enlightening. You know, what is there?
Yeah.
Camperet overstressed a few things, and he fell short, I think, in a few places, and in a few places he was just wrong. And I wish I knew now what I knew. You know, I wish I knew then what I know now, and could have done a better job on those notes. I told Clifton that the other day on the telephone that you know, with the I argued with Camperet, but not strongly enough. Because Camperet interpreted that star fallen from heaven in Revelation 8 as being Attila the Hun, and that's simply not possible. Attila had to be part of the stone cut out of the mountain without hands that sought to destroy the Roman Empire along with the Goths and the Vandals. And Attila the Hun was definitely a Germanic white man, and in spite of what the propagandists Jordanus and Cassiodorus said about him.
Yes, well, we're all growing in grace and knowledge, aren't we? I mean, the knowledge that has been given to us recently is just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly.
Well, if anybody is muted, well, I'm going to unmute the people that are muted. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Some of them are new. Hello, Ulster Man.
Hi there. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good evening.
How are you?
Hello.
Hi there, Ulster Man.
Hi, how are you today? I think you're the only one that knows who I am, probably.
Yes, that's right.
No, I know who you are.
Oh, do you? Good man.
Yeah, your first name begins with an M.
That's right.
I swear Tia didn't tell me, though, but I just figured that when I saw you appear here.
Yeah. Well, I can might give it away. The Ulster connection.
I can read between the lines.
Yes.
<Yeah.
laughs> Hello, how are you doing? Welcome to Christogenia.
Thanks very much. I've never used TeamSpeak before, never mind being on Christogenia, so hopefully it'll work out.
Yes, I pray. That'd be great. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks a lot. So no sign of Olam tonight?
Oh, he's a busy man, right? I mean, the family, the wife, the dogs, the job, the doctor thing. He's busy. He makes it here sometimes.
Well, actually, I talked to him earlier, but somebody called his house. I think a visitor came, and I'm not sure if he intended being on tonight or not, but he might turn up.
That's possible.
Yeah.
There are other people in Ulster, too, but Danny is in Ulster, but he's in California right now with an operation.
Yeah, an operation.
Yeah, has he had his operation yet?
Yes, he had it yesterday, and he emailed me last night, which I was really surprised at, and said everything was fine. Everything went well.
Oh, that's good.
So, hopefully
he's gone over there for a holiday, hadn't he? And then he had the opportunity of having the operation.
Yeah.
Yes, and from what he said last night, it's not much of a holiday. He's very unhappy. He said that people of our kind are very, very scarce there in Los Angeles.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Well, it's been completely overrun, hasn't it?
It needs to be pushed into the ocean. It really does.
Yeah.
there are some seismic events on the horizon which might just do that.
I pray Yahweh every day that Sodom and Gomorrah will be destroyed.
Yeah.
To me, that's New York and Los Angeles, right? or I should say that New York and that part of California that runs all the way from Los Angeles to San Francisco,
right,
which is also pretty bad.
Yeah.
I feel bad for the Irish. Ireland's being overrun.
Yeah.
And the British show. What's this? Somebody had sent me just today, and I have to... Papa Cat sent me this. He's sitting here. He sent me something that was a news item from Britain. I just got it in my email 2 minutes before this program started.
Oh,
a spate of thefts in several English towns and villages in Kent and Surrey over the past 2 months has led to many homeowners taking action to protect their property. The Daily Telegraph reports, some people have been warned by police that using wire mesh to reinforce shed windows was dangerous and could lead to criminals claiming compensation if they hurt themselves. This is absolutely pitiful. A police source said, homemade devices can cause injury, and there have been cases where criminals have sued for injuries they have suffered while committing a criminal act. We are advising people to do whatever they can to protect their property, but wire mesh is not one of the suggestions we would make. How pusillanimous is that? That's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't put wire mesh on your shed windows for fear some burglar might cut his fingernail?
Yeah.
Get a hangnail or a scrape or something? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, that's the state of Britain today. It's
As I understand it, if a burglar breaks his leg on your property while he's, you know, breaking in, you can be held responsible under certain circumstances. That's how stupid the law is.
Oh, if I catch a burglar on my property, I'm going to break both his legs.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I wouldn't say anything.
Utterly ridiculous.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Hello. I got a bit late, but well,
but
I have some questions.
Yeah, sure, Otilia. Otilia's in Romania, right? Or am I wrong?
Yeah.
Hello. Welcome to Christigenia.
Okay, thanks. So what I wanted to ask was, in one of the shows, you said that all of white people, like those who have the spirit of Yahweh, will be saved. Something like that, if I'm right. But I'm asking if, for instance, there are white people who commit murder or race mix or stuff like that, if they can possibly be saved.
Well, race mixing, you know, I don't know, there's a paper on my website, which I wrote, called Broken Cisterns.
Hmm.
And race mixing, yeah, you know, while the race mixer, while his spirit, I mean, Paul says that even fornicators can repent, right? And race mixing is a form of fornication.
Yeah.
So we can imagine that they could repent, and there are some former fornicators here. And maybe not here right now.
Yeah.
But they come, and they've repented of that. And they understand what they've done, and they know that it's wrong. But children, the race mixed children, can't possibly be saved because they're broken cisterns. They're not kind after kind, as we see the decree of God in the Bible on so many occasions.
So what you mean that after all, you know, even if you do race mix, you however have a possibility to be saved.
Well, yes, as long as you're not a bastard.
Yeah.
Because a bastard will never enter into the congregation of
Yahweh. Well,
I thought
it was like an unforgiving sin, and like murder, you know, take the life of someone. I mean, I don't know.
But, well, I understand what you're saying, Otilia. I really do. But, you know, God said in Isaiah and in Jeremiah that he would cleanse the sins of the children of Israel, and he made no exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, we as humans like to think that, you know, we like to look at our brother who has fallen and say, well, he has sinned so bad that he can't be forgiven. But Paul says that all Israel will be preserved, and when Yahweh said, I will cleanse their sins, he made no exception.
What about Satanists who completely, I don't know, refuse to deny God?
Well, right, but will they deny God when they die? I mean, there are people who appear to be white that aren't, and to that you could probably attribute a lot of the crime, but not all of it. Our people do horrible things all the time, and we have to recognize that. But he who has transgressed much and who is forgiven much will be the most grateful, and he who is forgiven little will be little grateful. That's also a parable, right?
Yeah.
Like the last son, you know, who came back and his father gave a big party.
Right, the prodigal son. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have another question. I sent you a mail, but, well,
I don't want you to think that I'm mean or ignoring you, but I have 2,000 emails.
I'm very confused about this thing because there are many archaeological evidence in Europe, you know, long before the Israeli tribes could migrate. And I'm really wondering who these people were, you know, like if they were Adamites, if they were, I don't know. I don't understand this.
I don't understand what you're saying.
I'm saying that in Europe, okay, there are evidence, you know, like archaeological evidence.
Yes.
Long before the Israeli tribes could migrate.
Well, right, and you know, we have.
I wonder who these people were.
If you look in Genesis chapter 10. And I have a paper on my website on Christogenia called The Race of Genesis 10. It talks about the Thracians and the Ionians and the Tarkesians and their presence in Europe at a very, very early time. And aside from that, in my Germanic Origins papers, I show from the testimony of the historian Herodotus And a couple of other sources, I think, where people of the Medes and the Persians had been migrating north of the Caucasus at a very early time. And what we have in Europe, like for instance with the Phrygians, right? The Phrygians of Anatolia were, by all ancient accounts, a branch of the race of the Thracians. Now, the Thracians are Tyras in Genesis chapter 10. The King James spells it T-A-R-I-S. They are the people of Thrace. Now, the Greeks counted them as barbarians because they spoke a different language. But they were a very advanced culture in what today we would know as Bulgaria.
Yeah.
It seems that they migrated along the Black Sea into parts of modern Romania, and this is 2500 BC that they may have been in these places already. Now, I go by the Septuagint chronology, which would date the flood of Noah to about 3300 BC. The Septuagint chronology is much more accurate and much more in line with what we know from history than the Masoretic text chronology that you find in the King James and most Bibles today.
Hmm.
Okay, so when I talk about history, I'm always following the Septuagint chronology when it comes into the purview of the Bible. Now, so we have these Thracians and other people migrating into the steppes at a very early time. But we have
For interrupting you, the Thracians were Adamites, were a branch of.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They were the Thracians were Genesis chapter 2, Tyrus.
Okay.
And they were in Bulgaria and possibly in Romania at as early as 2000 BC, 2500 BC.
Yeah.
And other tribes had been migrating into the steppe. And into what we would know as southern Russia, the Ukraine, the land north of the Danube. Herodotus puts colonists of the Medes, called the Sigynahi, north of the Danube in 500 BC. And the Sigynahi, we know from Strabo and Herodotus, originally lived on the shores of the Caspian Sea. Well, they had migrated into modern day, probably what we would consider today to be Romania and Hungary, before Herodotus' time, and around 500 BC. And these are Adamic tribes from Mesopotamia. So we have a long history, and we only have glimpses of it in our most ancient historical accounts. But we have 2,000 years of Adamic migration into Europe with no written history.
Yeah.
The first histories written in Europe are written in the 6th and 7th centuries B.C. And they're lost to us. We've lost Hecataeus of Abdera, who was probably the earliest known linear historian. Herodotus is 450 B.C. That's the oldest linear history we have. And the Greek poets that we have that predate him only go back as far as 600 B.C. or thereabouts. Yeah. Sappho and Homer and Hesiod.
Yeah.
So we really have a long history before we have any history.
Yeah, well, thanks for answering me.
Okay. But yeah, I would attribute that... That there are some very old findings that for instance, Cattle Hoyuk in central Anatolia that dates to 10,000 BC, perhaps. And it seems to. I don't argue that. I've read archaeology books about Cattle Hoyuk. But you know something? If you examine the archaeological remains of Cattle Hoyuk, you'll find that the motif and the symbols is very, very African and not connected to anything from Adamic culture later on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I think that may have been, that may have belonged to a pre-Adamic culture that wasn't really related to us.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are also finds in Europe that are similar. I don't like to talk about them because the history is so vague. And the nature of the findings can be interpreted so broadly that I really don't like to talk about it, but it they're not of our culture. I think they're of the fallen angels. That's what I really think.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't teach that as gospel because I can't prove it. There's a lot of things that are unexplained in archaeology from the most ancient times. But even the Greek classicists said that the gods laid the foundations of the temples. And some of the Greek writers described, they described cities that they moved into that they hadn't conquered. That they just moved into empty cities. And you could find some of that in Strabo and Diodorus Siculus. You'll find statements like that. And the planet has a history longer than the Adamic race, and we don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no history.
And the Adamic race, from the time that we were writing, the Bible was already an old book when we picked up pens in Europe. Yeah, you know, Homer didn't write until 600 B.C. Well, that wasn't until Jeremiah's time and the time of Daniel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I hope at the end of times we'll know the truth.
Well, yes, we will. But I would suggest that you read my Race of Genesis 10 paper. And it could be better. I could probably rewrite it and make it better now, but when I wrote it, I was in prison, and I was pretty focused because I only had a small library. Yeah, you know, it was I was limited to certain classics and the Bible, right?
Okay.
Thank you, Otilia.
See, but how long was Homer after the fall of Troy?
600 years almost. Yeah, you know, that first, yeah, let me say that there's a lot of writers, that there's a lot of modern writers that try to put Homer a lot earlier. But yeah. If you read the elegiac poet Archilochus,
yeah.
Okay, he was a contemporary of Homer, and he was writing approximately 585 B.C. And Homer had only written about a generation before him. And Homer mentions the Cimmerians in what I believe is he describes them as having come from the north, right? But modern archaeologists know that the Cimmerians invaded Phrygia from the east. And I think that Homer just possibly assumed that the Cimmerians had always dwelt in the north because that's where they were found by his time. But in Homer's lifetime, the Cimmerians invaded Phrygia and destroyed the Phrygian Empire. And migrated through the Bosphorus into what we would consider Thrace and Hungary today. That happened in Homer's time.
Yeah, yeah.
And Homer was definitely contemporary with Archilochus. From Archilochus, we could date Homer to have written about 610 to 600 B.C.
B.C., yeah, yeah. There you were.
Now, he was obviously recording things that happened long before his time.
Sure.
And the fall of Troy was probably around, and this can be pieced together from all the Greek accounts, was probably around 1185 B.C.
1185, oh, I thought 1250. Okay, 1150. Yeah, right.
1185 B.C. would be a safer. And that can be dated by Thucydides. Thucydides actually gives the exact number of years between the fall of Troy and the start of the Peloponnesian Wars in the opening chapters of his history. Maybe in the opening chapter of his. It's been a while since I've read it.
Yeah.
But it's right in Thucydides where he says it's been. I'm just going to throw a number out for purposes of illustration. Thucydides says it's been 730 years since the fall of Troy and the Peloponnesian Wars begin, right? Basically, he says something like that, putting an exact timing on it.
Yeah.
But it makes sense when you can. The dating of Thucydides makes sense when you look at the all the other Greek accounts relating the timing of the fall of Troy and the Dorian invasion of the Peloponnesus, and then when you look at the accounts from archaeology of when Mycenaean civilization fell and had arisen, it all makes pretty much sense, good sense, that Mycenaean civilization arose right around the time of the Exodus. It was the Danans who came from Egypt to Greece that founded it in the 15th century B.C., and it was they who fought against the Trojans at the opening years of the 12th century B.C., and Troy fell around 1185, and perhaps around 1100 B.C., we have the Dorian invasion and the destruction of Mycenaean culture.
Yeah.
Homer and Hesiod, too, and the other Homeric poets, there were others whose names we don't even know that. Well, we assume there were from the styles of writing. But, those poets that wrote the epic cycle and the Homerica and the Iliad and the Odyssey, they're writing about stuff that happened 600 years before their time. It would be like today we had no books and we sat down to write a story about Otto I or Charlemagne or Christopher Columbus.
Right.
You know, and we have no books. We only have a few myths handed down to us through the ages, right?
Yeah. Yeah, just a few stories and that's it. We have to make the book.
Right.
That works badly. Yeah.
And
did you have something written about all this in the Christogenia list? Is there something more to be found about all this? I think you had a lot of things written.
It's all in bits and places. I mean...
Yeah,
I remember writing somewhere about Archilochus and how I could show that he was how Archilochus shows that he was a contemporary with Homer. I wrote that somewhere on my site. I don't remember where.
Yeah. Okay, then you better work them through. Okay. But it's an interesting period all that time. For I know that we came along. Our family came from Anatolia in those days, and they told us that we were the early settlers. So then you're coming in 500 before B.C., and then even before that time. And that's just fitting. That's just what I want to know, all these informations. Okay, that's good to study. I'll find my way. Yep.
I love those little Loeb Library books from Harvard. I don't know if you could really obtain them I don't know. You could probably obtain them in Europe. I don't know if Oxford has anything better, right? But the Loeb Library books from Harvard have the Greek and the English or the Latin and the English. And I can't read the Greek like I read the English. I can in the New Testament, but the period of the classics, the Greek is a lot different. I can read it, yeah. and I could struggle with it and look words up in dictionaries and stuff like that, and I could check it out, right? I could check out the veracity of the translation I'm reading. And most of the classics, though, I read from English were that they were actually done by Englishmen, by British scholars, those British scholars that Dorcas was talking about before, back in the 19-teens and the 1920s. And they're now Harvard lately is replacing some of them with more modern translations, but those older translations I think are a real treasure.
Probably, yeah, most probably.
And that's the classics that I did get the chance to read. That's what I always tried to read was those Loeb libraries, with the exception of Rawlinson's Herodotus. I loved the Rawlinson brothers. They did us probably, out of all the English scholars, I think they were foremost in the 19th century. And I love George Rawlinson's Herodotus.
Was he a soldier as well?
No, he was a canon. Canon Rawlinson. His brother was a soldier and he was a priest.
Oh, it's his brother. That's it. Yeah.
Sir Henry Rawlinson decoded the Histon Rock while he was in service to the army of the Shah. And his brother, George Rawlinson, was the historian who had translated Herodotus, and he wrote several history books.
That's not on the internet.
George Rawlinson, I'm sure it's on the internet somewhere. I don't know if his Herodotus translation, I have a hard copy.
Yeah. But then you have to search under Greek history, probably.
Well, just search for George Rawlinson.
Yeah, that's easier. Yeah, okay. Right, okay. I'll do that. A lot to do.
If I was going to reread one of the classics I've read, that would be it. That would be first.
Yeah, okay.
I thought the book, too, was about Egypt was boring as hell, but once he got into the story of the Scythians in book three and followed that through to the Persian Wars, that was just that was a wonderful story. I hated to see it end.
Yeah.
It ended with the battles of Plataheer and Mycalae in 468 BC. I hated to see it end.
Yeah. Hey. That's a good tip, anyway. Certainly about the Scythians, because I know my mother is descendant from the Scythians. We found it out by DNA.
And what's your father's side of the family?
Anatolia, Celts.
Well, he's probably descendant of the Scythians too, right? You see, that's where people get all screwed up, Barbarian Man. It is by imagining the Celts to be different somehow. That's where the Jews trick us. Let me say the word Celt. I don't. Yeah, you know, there's conjecture about where it came from in the Celtic language, and I'm not going to get into it, but the people that we know as Celts were known in ancient times as Galatahi, and that's why we get Galatia, right, and the Galatians. Well, the Galatahi was the word that the Greeks gave to all of the Scythian tribes living north of the Danube. Now, when the Cimmerians...
Yeah.
But when the children of Israel were taken into Assyrian captivity, the people who inhabited the river basins in France and the coasts and I'm not talking about southern France, right? Because that was Phocian. It was predominantly Phocian Greek at the time. The people of Marseille were Phocian Greeks, right? And Ligurians, and I relate the Ligurians to the Etruscans, okay?
Right.
But I'm not going there. I'm talking about the rivers and the coasts of northern France and Brittany and Cornwall and Ireland. Those people were Phoenicians. They were all Phoenicians, and they were what anthropologists consider to be the proto-Celts, okay?
Right.
But when the children of Israel, when the children of Israel had been taken into Assyrian captivity, the people that we know as Cimmerians are the people that destroyed Nineveh, and then they crossed That was the branch of the Israelites that destroyed Nineveh, and then they crossed Anatolia and destroyed Phrygia. And then they crossed into Europe. And they basically departed from Mesopotamia at a very early time. So their language was not affected as much as the language of the Scythians, like the Goths and the Massagetae and the Vandals and those people who tarried in Asia for a long time and had extended intercourse with the people of Assyria and Persia and the other peoples of the steppe, and they had an extended intercourse, so their language was very different when they crossed into Europe. And a lot of those tribes didn't cross into Europe until the 3rd and 4th centuries A.D., almost 1,000 years after the Cimmerians had crossed into Europe. So when the Cimmerians came into Europe, that's what gives us the P Celtic and the Q Celtic, and the difference in the is the difference between the Cimmerians and the Proto Celts or the Phoenicians that were already there, and they were Israelites too. Okay, that now the Cimmerians would have retained much more of their original language, and they did, but they crossed into Europe first. First of all, the Germanic tribes, and at a very early time.
Yeah, the Germanic tribes, they came over to the north, over the Caspian.
But, and they had a lot more intercourse with the other Adamic peoples of the east, and they had a 1,000 years of departure from the Cimmerians. Now, Cimmerian, that word is from Cymru. That word, it's the Greek Cimmeroi, and when the Greeks learned about these people back in Homer's time, before 600 B.C., when the Greeks learned about these people, Akkadian was the lingua franca of Mesopotamia and Anatolia. Okay? Akkadian was the lingua franca because that's the Assyrian language, and the Assyrians had controlled all that land as their empire. Okay, so when the Greeks learned about these first waves of Scythians coming into Europe, they learned their name after the manner of the Akkadians, Cymri. So the Greeks called them Cimmeroi. Okay, well later on, after the passing of the Assyrian Empire, the Cimmerians were dispersed. The Greeks started calling them Galatahi. I have a theory on that. I can't prove. You know, Homer called those people milk eaters, right? As a disparaging term. And I think Galatahi comes from the Greek word galatas, which means of milk. It's the genitive form of the word for milk. Okay? So... Right, and the Greeks didn't start calling them that until about the 4th century. I don't find it's not in Herodotus, the word Galatahi.
Okay,
it's not in Herodotus in the 5th century. The word exists in the 4th century, and it's in some of the tragic poets, I think. But it's after Herodotus' time, and later. Well, anyway, Greeks called all these people Galatahi, but they were the people that were formerly called Cimmerians. Okay, and the Romans called Germania. Now but when the Scythians came later, the later tribes of Scythians came. The Greeks called them Sacca. Okay, that started crossing the Don and the Tanais River into Europe. The Greeks called them Sacca, but they called them Sacca because when those people started, those same children of Israel, just later times, later migrations, when those people crossed into Europe, the Greeks called them Sacca because that was the Persian name for them.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay? The Persians had now had the empire. The Persians controlled all the land of Anatolia and Mesopotamia, and the Greeks learned their name from the Persians. So they started calling these people, but they were the same people as the Cimmerians that crossed over in Assyrian times. Now, if you read Herodotus, Herodotus recites an inscription. I have a copy of the inscription in Herodotus. I talk about it in Classical Records in German Origins, Part 1, I talk about this inscription. I have two copies of this inscription. The first copy is the copy that Herodotus read. And the second copy I have is in ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament. That it's a book of ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions. They have the same inscription that Herodotus read. And where Herodotus says Cimmerians or Scythians, the actual inscription says Sakans in Persian. Yeah. And Cimmerians in Akkadian. There's all kinds of inscriptions like that, that are multilingual, that have Saka and Cimmerian, or Kimmeroy, or Cymry in Assyrian. Cymry and Saka are right next to each other in a bilingual inscription. Yeah. We know that the Saka are the Cymry. The Greeks called the first wave of them Cimmerians because that was after the Akkadian, and they called later waves of them Saka because that was after the Persian. But we go back to Mesopotamia, look at the inscriptions, and find out they're the same people.
The same people, yeah, correct.
And the Galatahi of Anatolia and Gaul, that's simply what the Greeks called the milk drinkers from north of the Danube.
Yeah. I still like milk.
Homer called, well, it was, yeah, you know, the people had very little agriculture because they were always on the move.
Yeah.
And to have agriculture, you have to be basically sedentary. And these people were in migrations.
They were on the move.
They relied on their flocks.
Yeah.
Well, the milk is not that healthy anyway.
Milk is not that healthy?
No, because...
Not for all
because,
people.
You know, we humans are just... The only, let's say, mammals who still drink milk after they grew up, you know, and it says that it's not that good for.
Well, you know, our ancestors well, would have been dead a long time ago without it. We wouldn't have been here.
And also, our Heavenly Father gave us a land flowing with milk and honey.
Yes, He did.
Yeah. It wasn't poison and honey.
Well, this is what I think about milk, Otilia. I think that the Jews have destroyed it. With the forced pasteurization and homogenization of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
To be honest, I'm not drinking milk for about some weeks, and I'm not feeling that tired anymore. You know, I used to drink milk every day, and I felt tired during the day. I mean, and sleep, and now I no longer feel that. And I think it's because of that.
Well, the last time I did without milk, I ended up with plantar fasciitis because I didn't have any. I was running all the time, and I had no calcium in my diet.
Oh, yeah.
And when I restored milk to my diet, my plantar fasciitis went away, and I could run again.
Yeah, yeah, they were, yeah. All of the milk is for calves. So I'm still a calf after 65 years.
How you doing, Alan Bottle?
Is he still muted?
Oh, well, he can unmute himself, or anybody with a C after their name can mute him.
Yeah.
Hello. How you been? Alum?
Fortler.
Well, he's unmuted and he's still muted.
Oh, he will come back.
Milk is for calves. I drink beer.
Oh, he's drinking beer. Yeah, can I?
But, well, anyway, the Greeks were a very refined and agricultural people, and they despised the Scythians because they drank milk.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, we still have it. I'll have it here straight from the cow, straight from the whore, from the...
And let me say something else, and this is really interesting, and I can't prove a connection, but the Greek word for cheese is the same exact spelling as the Greek name for tire. The city. Taurus, T-U-R-O-S.
Yeah. Taurus, yeah.
I just thought I'd throw that into the conversation.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I didn't know that.
Well, you didn't have hours to hang out with the Greek lexicon and nothing else to do, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
There's always a reason for a name being given to something.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
It would be interesting to find out the origin.
Right, it's always.
Well, I'm afraid that the origin is prehistorical, right?
Right.
Mostly. Yeah, that's what is in the name, huh? It's always in the name. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, okay, I'll see, find some time, and I'll go on the back and reread all these informations from the Greek whenever possible. Yeah. But then, on the other hand, I also have to pick up the information from the Revelations, which are coming now tomorrow and tomorrow and the weeks after. Lots of time to learn.
Yeah, I probably have another 2 months left with the Revelation, right? I'm guessing, but...
Yeah.
I'll do Revelation 12 and 13 next week.
Right. It's too early in the morning to raise. At 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
Well, that's why we have podcasts.
That's it. Yeah, we'll do. Hey, where's Sussex, man? He dropped out. He did forget it, probably.
I would like to add something.
Well, Tilia, you're breaking up a little. It's hard to hear. It's hard to understand.
Yeah. Coming back again. Okay, here you
okay,
are.
Okay, so I'm saying that as I'm living in Spain, I have to learn Spanish. And I have some books, and I say that they're just horrible because lessons are like this, feminism and how cool it is to be and how modern is to be a lonely woman. And then, Diary of a Skinhead and how...
The last thing we heard was Diary of a Skinhead.
Yeah. Dropped out.
I mean, they just put it in the books, just stuff like that, you know, like feminism and there were debate in the book about the family, but there was no traditional family. They were just homosexual, single, but there wasn't the traditional family to discuss about. That's, I don't know.
Well, if you read the Communist Manifesto and the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, you'll see that the goal of the enemies of our God is to destroy the family unit, and they've done a very good job of that.
Yeah.
And they've done it in a cultural war that most of us haven't even recognized, and what we call modern, it is really perverted.
Yeah,
and they were saying how awful it is to be a mother and to stay at home and take care of the children.
Well, that's that's a woman's traditional role has built our civilization. That's the most important role in society is for a woman to raise her own children. And because now the state raises our children, it's destroyed Christendom. It's destroyed our societies.
Yeah.
And the Jews have belittled the traditional role of a mother. And they've done that on purpose in order to destroy our families.
And they teach that to students.
Yes, they do teach that to students. But the traditional role of a woman, there could be no nobler role in our society than a woman who is faithful to her husband, stays home and raises her own children. Because the raising of those children is so crucial to future generations. That's the most important role in society. And the Jews have belittled it and have broken our view of it.
Absolutely.
They've done that. That fundamental building block of our society, of our civilization, has been destroyed.
Yeah.
And it is the most important role. Proverbs chapter 31, I think. The last chapter in Proverbs.
And in that chapter in Proverbs, it also says she considers a field and buys it, which, you know, suggests that although she was looking after the family and the household, her duties could extend beyond there. And,
of course, the woman is the head of the household, Judith. The woman is the steward over the household.
That's right.
I can't.
That doesn't mean just the cleaning part.
He is muted.
Alan, we can hear you.
Oh, all right. Right, okay. Hello, yeah.
Hello, Alan. How you doing?
Oh, hi. Yeah. I had a mic problem, I think. Yes, I joined you late. I have a copy of J.P. Mallory's book, In Search of the Indo-Europeans.
I read that also.
1989, yes. On one of the talk shows, I mentioned the map on page 144 of the birthplace of the Celts and the Indo-Europeans.
I mention that map and poke fun of it all the time.
Yeah. It's actually the modern consensus, inverted commas. It's just the academics from 1960, their ideas on the origin. And, yes, it does contain the Russian chap, is it Gam Kralidzki Ivanov, and he, I think he's got it right, draws his circle just above the Tigris, Mesopotamia.
Well, right, and that's also the Russian, I think I quote him in Classical Records in German Origins Part 5, but it might be Part 4, and I got his a little PDF that he wrote about the Sintasha culture on my website somewhere, and he also, and I think he drew on the work of the gentleman you just mentioned, but he also puts the Indo-European homeland in what we would call, I'm sorry, the word just left my mind. I had it, Kurdistan. Kurdistan, yeah, you know, Kurdistan is that area of where Syria and Turkey and Armenia all meet in along that one border region. That would be Kurdistan. Well, if you examine that in the biblical context, I believe that that's the ancient land of Arphaxad, and that's where Haran was, the ancient land of Abraham's ancestors, and that's where Paddan Aram was, but where Abraham had sent back to get kinsmen for his son Isaac. And that's, yes, that is right, but that's the only one that's valid. All those other people are jokers.
Yeah. Well, if you have a look at these children, these children from the Kurdan, and when you're looking carefully at them, the rare times that they are coming on the television, and then you can see on their faces that very often these children do have white faces, blonde hair, blue eyes, and if you both have them speaking English or German or whatever from Europe, then they're equal to us. And then you see the father or the mother, either one of them is still white, but it comes up that you're still born from that area. So that's fitting correctly.
Well, that's why I'm glad Ottilia is here, and you know, a couple of weeks, she Excoria, she really got on me hard. A couple of weeks ago, Sword Brethren made a comment about Romania, and how hardly any of it's white or whatever, and I agreed with him, and I'm going to tell you why I agreed with him. Yeah, you know, I've met a lot of people that claim to be Romanians in my life, and especially, you know, I'm from New York City. I'm from Jersey City, which is right across the water from New York City, right? And everybody in the world is there. You meet everybody there. If you want to meet somebody from Bangladesh, go to New York. If you want to meet somebody from Thailand, Brazil, Argentina, I don't care where it is. You'll find one in New York, right? Well, anyway, I met a lot of Romanians, and they all look like gypsies or Turks to me.
Yeah.
Every Romanian I ever met. So when Brian said that Romania was not really a white nation anymore, I from my life experience, I would have to accept that because of the Romanians that I've met. Well, Ottilia sent me a picture. She got offended, and I kind of don't blame her after I saw the pictures. She sent me like three pictures of I guess her school chums or whatever,
friends
in Romania, and I would say about 90% of those people look like they could have been walking the streets of Ulster or Saxony, right? I was surprised. I was happy, but I was surprised, right?
I'll make a thread about that in the forum.
She's going to make a thread on that in the forum and educate us on Romania, I hope.
Yeah, okay, that's good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's worth it.
I mean, I have a thread in the Christogenia forum about Estonia, and I saw these four or five YouTubes of a concert, and it was kind of a patriotic concert in Estonia, and I was really heartened by it. I mean, I thought it was great to see that many people that cared about, that were white, that cared about their race and their culture.
Yeah. That's good that we have them. You better have them straight from these countries.
It's quite offensive, everyone, to when you say you're from Romania, to say you're a gypsy, you know, that's because there are many gypsies there, and just ruin the image of our country.
Well, obviously they have, Otilia, because they have in my mind. I mean, when I think Romanian because of my life experience, I think gypsy. I mean, that's the way it is. And you know, yeah. I'll tell you, there are a lot of Italians that come here, and they're almost certainly white, and they believe the message, and they accept it. And there's Spaniards, right? Not all the Spaniards are Moors, and not all the Italians are Arabs. But when I use Spain and Italy as examples of what happens to a society that becomes a mixed race society, I catch some hell for it. But those people basically know what I'm saying and can see what I'm saying. And that's the way it is. It's hard to pick an example out where you're not going to offend somebody. I was born and raised in. Well, I wasn't born. I was raised in New Jersey. 2 miles from New York City, I could see the World Trade Center from my house before they blew it up.
Right.
And I use New York as an example of places infested by the Jews, even though I'm a New Yorker, right? I mean, that's we have to face. We have to face the reality of the situation. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, my aunt lives in Italy, and she says it's a very big difference between the South and the North. The North are like white people, and in the South they are like very, very, very bad.
But, well, yes, I would agree with that. A lot of people say that Africa starts below Naples, right?
Yeah.
Can I just interject? I think it was a tank of kerosene and gravity that brought down three...
Yeah, right. Okay, Alan.
one tank and three skyscrapers.
Yeah, I know. That's amazing, the World Trade Center and the things that people could believe. That plane brought that down Building 7, too, I guess, hours later.
Yeah, but it's a tail section.
Most people down in any building, no idea.
Alan, you're cutting out a little, so we're not getting every sentence, right?
Yeah.
I've increased the sensitivity to 20. Would that be better?
30 might be even better.
Yeah.
Right. Now I'm sitting at 30.
Okay. Try.
Would that be better?
I hope.
Yeah, okay. Let's try.
Do I have to press apply?
Huh? Yes. We might get feedback if you set it too high, though.
Yeah. One, two, three. Clusterfuck. No? Is he coming or not?
Alan?
I think he's set it too high. I think it has to go to the left if you want to increase the sensitivity.
I think he's trying to test it or something. He's blocked it.
Yeah, okay.
Hello?
Oh, here he is.
It doesn't actually...
Back again.
It gives a graph, but it doesn't tell you what the parameters are. It doesn't say what the graph represents. It's just numbers, minus and plus numbers. But
it works.
I have pulled it down to minus 10. Is that better?
Yeah, that would make it more sensitive.
Okay.
Keep going.
That's more sensitive. Minus 10. Okay, sorry to interrupt. I think that's helping.
That's sounding a lot better.
Yeah. Is Ulsterman lurking out there?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he's here.
Stand by.
Hi, how are you?
That sounds like a County Down accent, you know? I'm an Anglo-Irish. My accent's probably halfway between Ireland and Scotland and England.
But, well, you can tell the difference, right? But we in America, you all sound the same to us.
Alan's just a lot more polite than I am. I think that's the difference.
Ollam Fodlug. Get it right, Ulster.
Sorry, Ollam. Yeah, sorry about that.
That might be Ulster Man. No, I'm kidding.
So I haven't been here for a few weeks. There's a few new names. Otilla's from Romania, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I live in Spain.
It's not Otilia the Hun.
No,
it's a Germanic name. It's a Germanic name. It means like fortune, wealth.
All right.
We might be calling her that soon, though, Nam. I'm just kidding.
That is good. We have them now from Spain, from Denmark, Germany, England. That's good.
Well, Tilly has been listening to the talk show programs, and she's been reading on Chris Degenia.
Yeah, perfect. Good to hear. Yeah. The more the better.
And she joined the forum like Matthew finally did last week also.
Well, Gallo introduced me to Christian Identity.
Yeah, that's great. Gallo's a great guy.
Good.
Yeah.
Yes, I was listening to an old show, and yes, Bill mentioned J.P. Mallory, and it just dawned on me that I'd actually bought this book in a second-hand bookshop, and so I have actually read bits of it, but I'm intrigued with the migrations. I don't know how many of you have seen that little green book published by Covenant Publishing way back in the 1950s, I think, on the migration. It's by Filmer, a chap, Mr. Filmer.
Oh, yes.
And it's a book of maps of the migrations. It's got about 20 little sketch maps, and it's quite good, but I suspect some of it is a bit wrong. It copies a lot of modern textbooks in having big arrows coming out of sort of Austria with the Celts migrating eastwards into Anatolia, Asia Minor. But right. I think that's a misleading arrow. I suspect most of the migrations were westwards and northwards. And they have done this deliberately to deceive us into thinking that the Celto-Saxons originated somewhere around Switzerland, Austria, and not the Levant.
Well, right. It's the Cimmerians crossed into... Cimmerians came from the east. They destroyed Phrygia. Yeah. They crossed the Bosphorus. They went up into the Danube River Valley. By 500 B.C., they were settled along the Danube River, where they had to already run into settlements that were made by the Malaysians. The Malaysians had settlements around the Black Sea and the Ukraine and in modern Romania and Bulgaria, that they had, the Malaysians had settlements there probably by 800 B.C. Now and along the Danube River. Now the Cimmerians entered that area in 500 B.C. If you look at the modern anthropologists and archaeologists like to say that the Cimmerians disappeared on the plains of Hungary circa 500 B.C. Well, yeah, they did. They dispersed from the plains of Hungary. By 400 B.C., a bunch of them were on the Baltic Ocean, and crossing into Britain as the Cimbri, and another bunch of them were invading Rome and taking the cities of Etruria, and they sacked Rome by 390 B.C., and another bunch of them crossed the Rhine and migrated into Gaul.
Right. Yes, but I think some of them stayed in Turkey become
the Galatahi of Turkey, you know, 300, 400 years after the Cimmerian cross, 400 years after the Cimmerians crossed the Bosphorus and started to settle along the Danube and migrate down the Danube and branch out into northern Italy and Germany and France, right? That this all happened from 600 to 400 B.C. Now, right. About 220 B.C., a group of the Galatahi, descendants of these same Cimmerians, they decided to raid Greece. They wanted loot. They wanted booty. That's what they wanted. And they wanted better land. And the good land was all south of the Danube. So they crossed the Danube, and they invade Greece, and they looted the... I think they looted the temple of Apollo at Olympus. I'm pretty sure they looted Greece I think they threatened Athens, and they crossed into Anatolia, and they wanted to loot Pergamus. And Adalid, the king of Pergamus, had defeated them in a battle. But it was not a decisive defeat. And what he did was he made a deal with them to give them this ancient land in Phrygia, and he gave them the land. But this is all well known from Polybius and other classical historians.
So are you indeed saying that there was an eastward later migration?
Well, yeah, it was some of the Germanic tribes crossed back across the Danube River and pillaged Greece and Pergamus, and were given land. They were given land in Anatolia as a result of a treaty of peace with the Attalid kings, with Attalus I.
The New Testament Galatians.
That's them.
Right. We'll have to anchor it into the scriptures, you see.
Because they were the dispersed Scythians. They were a group of the dispersed Scythians.
So
but they're only a small group of them. They're not even a big group of them. The Celts under Brennus, right. The Galatahi under Brennus.
Yeah.
So the migrations weren't always westwards. There was occasional regurgitations back east.
Well, this one, yeah, because they wanted better land. You know, the Scythians that were north of the Danube and east of the Rhine, that land sucked, Alan.
Yeah,
it was cold. It was rough.
Yeah.
It was not cultivated. It was heavily forested. It was heavy with swamps. And nobody wanted to stay there. And even Julius Caesar complained that the Germanic tribes were always trying to press west of the Rhine and south of the Danube. Because the land in Greece and Pannonia Dalmatia and northern Italy and Gaul was all much better land.
Is the land in Asia Minor, Turkey, is it fertile? I've never been there, you know.
Well, yes, at that time it was very fertile, and not only was it fertile, but you know, Pergamus was a very rich kingdom, and those Persian provinces, excuse me. Persian provinces of Anatolia were always very rich provinces. That land was a very rich land. It's the Turks that have turned it into a desert, but that's what the other races do wherever they go.
Yeah.
And the mixed races. And the Turks are a mixed race. The Arabs, wherever they go, you're going to have Arabia. The Africans, wherever they go, you're going to have Africa. The Mexicans, wherever they go, you're going to have Mexico.
That's controversial, of course.
So Anatolia is a very rich land and very fertile, and it's a land of milk and honey. It's a land of milk all through the Byzantine period. It's a land of milk and honey. But when you take Arabs and put them in a land, you're going to have Arabia.
I didn't appreciate this, but I mean, back to J.P. Mallory's diagram, you know, map. It's a cutoff at 1960, and I suspect most of the historians before 1960 got the origin correct, and therefore the Mallory and most of these university academics are dismiss all sort of books published in the 19th century, even the 18th century. Because those people had Christian roots from 1900, particularly from the 60s onwards, almost 100% of university historians will be secular sort of atheists.
Well, right. If they're not Jews by blood, they're Jews between the ears.
They have an interest in confusing and deceiving people into thinking.
Right.
The Anglo-Celto-Saxons originated somewhere north of the Alps, you know, and hide the true origin. But to get this knowledge out to the ordinary people, I'm appealing for someone to update Filmer's book, you know, to correct some of the mistakes and to have a little book, you know, 10, 20 pages with lots of diagrams with arrows showing these migrations, because it's very difficult for us ordinary people that haven't studied to get our heads round it, you know.
Oh, that's great, but I'm not a guy. I mean, you'll find somebody.
I wonder, could we find someone, because the academics are never going to do it, because they want to preserve this deception. And, you know, who obviously BIWF aren't going to do it. Some of us are going to have to try and produce something that we can actually hand out to people and say, look, this is where you came from.
What about James Cowles Pritchard, The Eastern Origin of the Celtic Nations?
I haven't heard of him.
Well, check that book out.
Pritchard, yeah, P-R-I-C.
1836. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read a lot of good quotes from it.
All right, yeah. Well, my local historians, they dismiss all books published in the 1700s and 1800s.
Well, I dismiss them, right?
Yes.
I would dismiss them. I would tell them that, too. I would tell them that none of nothing of what they esteem is worth 2 cents.
Yeah, because any historian that mentions their Christian credentials, they automatically dismiss them as fools, you know?
Yeah, but we don't have any need to have anything to do with them.
Exactly.
We need leaflets. We need propaganda. We need...
Yes, but we can do all
publications.
That.
Yeah. Well, I'm just hoping to appeal to some enthusiastic writer, you know, might have...
Why don't you get all the details and let somebody else put it together?
Well, that's...
It's got to be a joint effort.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you start by reading my 6 Germanic Origins essays?
Yeah. There's a lot to read, yeah. I'll start there soon, yeah.
Yeah, you better do. I'm going to do either. First, I'm downloading the 1 minute, 2 seconds from the Eastern Origin of Pritchard, the PDF. Yeah. Okay.
Hello, Michael. Michael from New Zealand is actually in the Ukraine.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like Otilia the Romanian is in Spain, Michael from New Zealand is in the Ukraine. Danny the American is in Ireland, but he's in America right now, so.
Yeah. We have all the opportunities. Yeah.
Hello, Michael.
Let him come in.
Oh, he has his microphone muted. He might be busy.
Okay.
He has his hands filled with two young boys and...
Yeah. House full. Okay, all files have finished downloading.
Michael's typing. He's here with us, but he's typing. He's not talking to us. Glad you made it, Michael.
Okay, yeah.
It's got to be late there right now. It's got to be probably 11 o'clock.
No, here's 9 o'clock.
Is it, in the Ukraine, it's 9 o'clock only? Okay.
I think in Ukraine, it's 10 now. Yeah.
Okay. Well, close.
1 hour time difference? Not more? From here to, yes, Eastern time is Moscow. Yeah, it could be. Yeah, 10 o'clock about. Yeah, that's right. Well, we can ask him, what time is it with you?
I'm lucky I know what time it is in New York, so.
Yeah.
So what else do we have to talk about today? We have to have something more than that. Don't everybody jump at once now.
Well, I have something, but I don't know if it's the right place to say it. But, well, anyway. I was searching YouTube, you know, and you know, there is Eurovision, that competition of songs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this Norway competes with a black woman that doesn't represent Norway anyway.
Wow.
So she's ugly, she has like stupid lyrics, and her voice is just horrible. And I just put it in YouTube, you know, that she's horrible from all points of view and has nothing to do with Europe. And that this guy who is half Norwegian, half African, and he's proud of it, he said in his YouTube channel. And he said that, what do I have to do with Norway, and why do I say these horrible things? And he said something that just not that it's something that not to mess with his Europe, and that stuff like that.
I would bet.
African saying to me that he has more to do with Norway than me, who I'm white. Like, well,
the impression I get is that he's probably not African at all, and he's probably not Norwegian at all. He's probably a Jew, and the Jews in Israel, they have thousands of people whose employment is to spread Jewish propaganda on the internet, and that's what they get paid to do.
Well, he has videos of Nigerian kids, you know, all the horrible stuff.
They have nothing better to do than to spread race mixing and pro-Jewish propaganda on the internet.
Well, it's just a shame because Norway, it's a Nordic country and has beautiful people, you know, beautiful voices, and they put just a black woman there, you know, to represent.
Yeah.
And above all, a very bad song.
Yeah, that goes hand in hand with the destruction of our culture.
Yeah.
But they're all desperately trying to be politically... It's like the British bid for the Olympic Games in 2000. They deliberately chose kids and adolescents to dance and sing. And apparently the Olympic team were so impressed by the diversity, the multiculturalism, awarded Britain the Games. So... same thinking, probably in Norway. Let's put forward a Negro, and we some brownie points with the international establishment. They have to try to prove that they're not racist. You see, so she was probably picked because of her skin, not because of her voice.
Well, I'm certain it's an absolutely horrible situation. I think that's where Isaiah said that the children of Israel would lay on their backs and spread their legs to everybody that walked by, and that's exactly the way he put it. And that's exactly what we're doing.
As Icelander says, you know, they put Israel, Armenia, all kinds of countries, but it's Eurovision, you know. It's not it's not about any other country, just European countries.
Mm.
But I think European country, this is like new, putting all these non-European countries in.
Yes, it's a deliberate policy, just like the European Union is trying to attract countries like Turkey and keeps, you know, sort of promising them entry into the European Union. Well, you know, it's just so incongruous.
Just imagine Turkey entering the European Union.
Cool.
Just imagine how many Muslims will just fall in.
75 million in Turkey.
Yeah, the mayor of London, so-called Boris Johnson, he's lobbying hard to get Turkey to join the... But I understand, even though he is blonde, he has got Turkish ancestry.
I didn't know that.
He's a conservative, and I think he's got the ear of our Cameron... to try and get the Turks. That means that we in Britain could be flooded with 10 million more Muslims very soon, you know.
Right.
But to them, you know, it's great increasing the power and the number of citizens in the European Union. That appeals to their egos. I think they've got a biggest organization now in the world. So they're not thinking of the practical problems that it'll create. They're just carried away and they're grandiose.
Well, they don't love their country. That's
no. Well, they haven't got one.
Or no thought for their country. No.
The thing that is happening in Europe is that there come many, many people from third world countries, and they just take the jobs of indigenous European people. Yeah, and for instance, in Spain, there are 4 million, I think, people who don't have jobs.
Yes, in Britain, I think they've supposedly created 750,000 jobs, but 90% of those have gone to foreigners. So most of the unemployed in Britain are happy living on their benefits and letting the foreigners take their work and do the monotonous and dirty and dangerous work. And of course, it's a deliberate policy. The benefits system is so generous that it pays people home or plane sickness. And that gives the politicians the excuse to doors open to mass immigration. But because they simply protest, look, our people won't do the work, so we have to bring these people in. But they decide on the levels of benefits and make it easy, cut them back and force people back out to work. But they won't do that. So the powerful people controlling the parties this is a deliberate policy. And the medical profession has been attracting in doctors since most people love doctors and think that we are unable to produce enough doctors for our wonderful service.
Well, I think that what happened is that the schools became so, like, easy for children. You know, for instance, in Romania, the school is more harder than in the schools in Western Europe. They made the schools, like, very, very easy. And I don't know, so that the kids would just, I don't know, wouldn't just develop themselves and want to continue their studies.
No, that's deliberate. Mm. They're eliminating the boundaries of these countries. That's all this immigration. So there'll be one mass of mixed people, and they won't have individual loyalties to their country. That's all going. This is all planned. So the world will be ruled. And we will all be dotted here and there, all mixed up. And that's what they're planning. And that's what's happening. And they seem to be achieving their goal.
Yes, just as an aside, it's good to be talking to people like Otilia, Romanians. I was brought up in Ulster, rarely ever met Scotsman, let alone a Frenchman, let alone a Romanian. So it's we are the true multiculturalists. We have over 50 years have broken down the barriers, Christian identity. We are happy to talk to Scandinavians, Eastern European, white people, whereas we were certainly brought up quite narrow-minded. It was a very close society where I grew up, and we were indeed quite suspicious of people, even from Liverpool, let alone from Romania, where British Israel, Christian Israel identity is actually multicultural, but not multi-ethnic.
Well, in Romania, like, Christian identity is, like, very, very unpopular, but I don't know why is that, but most of the Romanian people are Christian, they believe in God, they are Orthodox Christian. I mean, most of them, yeah, unlike the West, in the East, people are more faithful.
Yes, well, there's Christian and there's Christian. I've slowly realized that most of the people I thought were Christian, anti-Christian, that seem to be against what Bible properly translated, some of our worst enemies now are church people.
For instance, when I used to talk with my grandma, she said to me that in her time, the priest would not have married you with a gypsy or a Jew. It was like you were an outcast if you would do that.
Yes, 60 years ago in this city here, none of the clergymen were marriages. Now, I would say 90% of them were great. So that massive change in culture has only taken 60 years. But that 60 years corresponds to 60 years of television. And I think the British invented TV. We've probably watched more TV than anybody. Probably you haven't been as exposed to the effects of TV in Europe.
Yeah. Well, when I see those cartoons of black kids and white kids, best friends, and then I see one in the street, you know, black kids with white kids on the best friend, I think, well, that's the result of television.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt, happens here all the time. Makes me sick. Before you know it, that little black kid is with that white kid's sister. He's pregnant.
Well, in Romania, there are many black people, you know, and most of them would not marry a black person, you know.
Well, here in Britain, on TV, most of the ads have their mixed race couples or blacks and whites kissing.
Yeah, it's
Romania now.
Yeah.
By the way, I watched 10 minutes of BBC last Friday night to see what was happening in Egypt with the uprising, and see primary sort of intellectual news program Newsnight, which is anchored by a chap, Jeremy Paxman, who's one of our friends, you know. Edomite friends. He's actually quite fair, I think, most things. But he had three on the panel talking about, you know, what was going to happen in Egypt, you know, what sort of government was going to emerge. And one, the lady, she took nose Arab, so she was similar Edomite blood. And the other two on the panel were ostensibly British, but one was a half-American chap, Simon Sharma, who's a favourite historian with the BBC class, you know. He's written lots of books. And
I don't think he's American.
Well, he certainly has a sort of New York-y accent.
Hey, he's a Jew.
Is he? Oh, yes, he is a Jew, but I think he's sort of, He originated in your part of the world, Bill.
I wouldn't call Nathan Rothschild an Englishman.
Right. So the third member of the panel was another Jew, ostensibly a converted to Anglican Jew.
So he's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yes. Well, his father was a big bishop of Birmingham, and he was a very popular after-dinner speaker. Bishop Montefiore. Now, this is the son, and the son has written a very good book on Stalin and produced a lot of audio CDs, which I have been listening to, actually, on Stalin, the Red Tsar. But he's supposed to be an Anglican, but, I mean, he makes no bones that he thinks and talks like a Jew. So, basically, we had three and a half Jews out of a panel of four on the BBC talking about Egypt. So how do we get an informed, balanced position there? Three and a half out of four. And I'm saying that the Arab woman had a very Edomite-looking nose, you know.
But Olam, if you're listening to television, you're not going to get a balanced view out of controlled media.
We need to keep in touch with what people are watching.
I don't think so at all.
Well, I do, because they have a monopoly.
Not especially the BBC.
No. I don't even turn it on if I can help it.
Well, 80% of it is true. It's the 20% that's lies that we have to try and identify.
Well,
I do need it, and I like to keep in touch with what ordinary people, because I'm partly in the business of trying to spread this message.
It will affect you adversely.
We need to be exposed to what ordinary people are exposed to.
No, you come come out of it, my people.
But
come out.
With some Babylon. Knowledge. Oh, yeah. I'm not in it, but I observe it, you know.
Well, I think the best things in TV are the documentaries about planet, animals, you know, stuff like that. I like to watch that, even though they ruin the show with during so many years of evolution. But apart from that, it's very beautiful to watch.
But Attilia, there's always that little bit of poison there, isn't there? You've got a beautiful wildlife film, and then there's that constant drip, drip, drip of the evolution.
Yes.
Yeah, nothing, it's just
nothing on these programs. Nothing ever changes. Everything evolves.
Yeah, during so many years of evolution,
they cannot resist.
So
they can, and people, ordinary people, caught up on it. They ought to be using words like change, but they automatically are brainwashed to saying everything happening is evolving, you know.
It's marvelous. This wonderful landscape, these amazing animals, you know, sometimes about universe, and then just you say that all these things just came there out of nothing. It's just like, I don't know.
Yes, the nature programs are good, but if you have a certain amount of knowledge where they're throwing in their evolution propaganda, I think more people are realizing that channel total gospel. You know, some people are spotting the propaganda, but I think it's still useful to at least observe this and so as you can see what's going on and warn people. You know, if you've never watched any of these televangelists at work,
I wish to.
Well, I think it's very important.
I just think it's a waste of time.
I believe in mental hygiene. I'm with Judith. I'm sorry.
The word of God dwell in you richly while ever you're watching that trash.
Mm-hmm.
It's mental hygiene, Alan.
Yeah. Obviously, get too much, yeah. But occasionally, dip in, see what's going on.
Never. I haven't watched television since 1996. I don't plan on it. It's straight garbage to me. I hate being subjected to it. My mother and grandmother live here, and I got to deal with it 2 hours a night with them. I spend almost all of that 2 hours down here, and they only watch television 2 hours a night, but it's a horrible scene.
And Alan, you could be writing that CI tract.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think it's better internet because you can choose the information there you want to waste your time on, let's say.
I think it's a process of coming out, you know.
Yeah, step by step.
Well, I could emphasize with Alan a little bit about where he... you know, he might want to know about current events to the extent that he could talk to the people that he encounters every day, but I think I get enough of that just in the garbage I find in my email 300 times a day.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the British news recently, ever since the troubles kicked off in Egypt, that's all we've had. We never hear a thing about our kith and kin in New Zealand or Australia or any other part of the world.
Right.
Yeah. You know, even when they're flooded, they only get a scant mention.
Yeah.
So I don't see the point in all this repetition. And then when I do occasionally hear it, the anchorman will be asked, and what's your take on this? You know, you don't get the facts so that you can make your own assessment of the situation.
Well, last year there were some big floods in Romania and many people without houses. I don't think there was any like aid, anything like that throughout Europe, no? Yeah.
I never heard about it, Otilia. So yeah, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, there are big floods like in two years, like, let's say... 2 years ago, 1 year ago, were big floods in Romania.
Well, we only hear about it when it happens to dark people's countries. We don't hear about it when it happens to white people's countries.
Yeah. If Romania had oil or gas or diamonds or heroin, you know, poppies.
Or a brown population.
We'd definitely hear about it, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Well, it has a lot of gold in the mountains, but I don't know why Romanian people don't go there extract it. They I think they wanted to sell the mountains to the Americans.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
You mean to the Jews that are living in America that have all our money?
Yeah. It's too much work for the Jews to get the gold.
Well,
out
I
there.
Think to the Jews, to the American Jews.
As soon as they sell the mountains to the Jewish investment bankers in New York, the Jewish investment bankers are going to flood Romania with Mongols to hire to mine the gold, right?
Yeah.
Really. I don't know what happened. I just know that they were about selling that mountain.
Yeah. That's probably there.
I've got a metal detector in my garage. I'll come and join you. You know, we'll head for the
Yeah.
Well, Icelander wants to talk about ice saves, but he doesn't want to open up his microphone and tell us about it. But we might have to miss that conversation.
Yeah.
He's certainly using some florid language here, you know.
He's disgusted about the Icelandic people having to pay for the failure of some Jewish bank in Reykjavik, I guess. But I don't know enough about it, and
but at least he had the backbone to refuse, Bill.
I hope so, but if he doesn't come on and elucidate us, we'll never know.
Yeah, it'd be good to have an update.
I'm trying really hard to put him on the spot to make him come tell us about Ice Saves.
But
he's holding out.
More nice.
Probably bathing in one of these warm geysers with a bottle of beer in his hand, you know?
Yeah.
Alan's telling us about all his deepest desires.
Oh, concerning that beer. Hey, yeah, hi. Come in.
Good afternoon, Bill. Good evening, everyone.
Hello, Michael. Hi. How you doing?
Hi, hey, Michael. Come in.
It's good to be here.
Great to have you.
At long last.
Well, you must have your hands filled with those children, right?
Well, they've just gone to sleep. So that's
there you have it.
Hey, thank you.
It's good news if they stay that way for.
Sorry.
It's 10:20. 10:20.
Yeah,
right. So
it's 2 hours.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. It's an hour's difference, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's Eastern European time. That's correct. It's an hour difference with us here in Germany. That's right.
So what's been the discussion this evening?
Oh, there was a lot.
Why don't you ask us what hasn't been a discussion?
Okay.
Yeah. We've been about all over the map.
Yeah.
Right.
We've been talking a bit about the ancient migrations from...
along the Krim.
Across Europe, you know, from the Mesopotamia.
And okay.
J.P. Mallory's book from 1989 on the In Search of the Indo-European.
J.P. Mallory, yeah.
But Bill mentioned this interesting map on page 144 where all the Europe's university academic historians have plumped where they think the Celto-Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Nordic people originated.
Right.
But it's only since 1960. So I guess most of the academics before 1960... would have got the answer right, but on this map, there's only one Russian historian that's plumped for the right place, modern Kurdistan, just south of Armenia, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the circles are around the Alps, you know, the Central Europe.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to make the point that suits the academics.
Right.
And their sponsors, they want to hide the origin in the plant, you know, Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also appealing for someone play, you know, to interested to update an old BI Covenant Publishing booklet of 20 pages by a preacher, Filmer.
Mm-hmm.
Where he gives lots of about 20 maps of with arrows of the Scythians and the Sarmatians and the Celts and the Angles and Saxons, and I doubt if anybody's going to produce anything outside I. So, but between us, we'll have to try and come up with an update, a more accurate update, and something that we can actually get published, possibly on Lulu or something, and hand out to people. Mm-hmm. Because I think modern people are spoon-fed. They don't like to read lots of text. They like maps and diagrams and pictures.
Also, you too, you know, when I wanted to see if there's something about Christian identity on YouTube, I step across black Israelites, you know, like blacks consider themselves being the last tribes, and I think YouTube is just full of them, you know. I couldn't find anything about Christian identity.
Well, of course,
you should find something.
I just found something about black Israelites, and I said, okay, I don't want to search anymore.
What keywords were you using? I suppose Christian Israel identity or British Israel would be the best search terms.
I'll try with that. Maybe I'll find something. Yeah, well, I put in something like true Israel, you know, like...
I don't think that would work.
I don't know, something like that, Israelites, migrations. About Christian, what people would put, you know, about Israel, and they came only black Israelites and stuff like that.
I don't really do YouTube. Eli's done some, I don't know how good they are, right? Eli's done some YouTubes. Skip Baker's done some YouTubes. Skip is a real nice guy with a good heart and a lot of zeal, but he's short on knowledge. And his history is obscured, or I should say obfuscated would be a better word for it. I don't know if there's anybody out, if there's a lot of people putting out videos. I know that Covenant People's Fellowship does, and they have a YouTube channel, and they do a lot of that stuff. And Mike Delaney does a lot of YouTubes. I don't. A few other people have taken some of my work and some of Sword Brethren's work and put it to YouTubes from our audios, especially on the World War II Germany programs that we've done. But I don't think you're going to find a whole lot of real good. Instructional Christian identity videos. I mean, there's...
And features rather than textures, you know?
Well, the BIWF, British Israel World Federation, so-called, you know, based in England, they have some videos out, short ones, you know, 10-minute ones. But the doctrine's a bit weak, you know, that they are quite universalist. Cool. But they have the resource, or they had the resources anyway. But yes, I've seen quite a few videos. But there's a lot of dodgy disinformation, you know, slagging us off. So obviously you have to be aware of that. Skip over those.
Yeah, but they're little, you know, little videos. I think
legal.
You know.
Yeah, but yes, I think I've watched a few Eli James videos. Certainly, he's got a few on the front page of his website, as has Bill. So if you like watching videos, there's plenty about.
Yeah, usually people, I think, learn faster with pictures and videos and stuff like that. It's more easy sometimes. And YouTube is very popular among people, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, well, I know nobody likes to read. I mean, for every 1,000 people that have read one of my papers, I get 3,000 downloads on a podcast, usually. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it depends. If you're middle-aged like me, you like to have something hard, turn a page, get a black pen and a lighter, and, you know, if you're appealing to... Church folk, you know, most of them are over 60 anyway, and wouldn't know what a video is. So I think the printed word is still useful.
Fortunately, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's usually useful to show people where the videos are.
That is right, yeah.
I get discouraged sometimes because if you take, like my German origins papers, some of them have like 1,000 reads maybe or close to it. But a podcast, my Subi Sisters podcast has 9,000 downloads.
Uh-huh.
So it's, yeah, you know, it's a great disparity. A lot more people would rather just listen or watch a video than actually read. It's crazy.
And it takes far more little time also, you know. I mean, people perhaps don't have so much time, and it's more easier to, like, I don't know, do something, clean something, and listen while, meanwhile, you know. I don't
They don't have so much time because they'd rather watch the BBC.
are you getting at me again?
Now, I didn't say that. I could have said television, but I wanted to put it in a European context, I swear. Ellen has a guilty conscience.
The Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation.
It's always surprised me as to why people can't make the connection. We call ourselves Caucasian. And yet now we're coming up believing that Europeans...
We should have called ourselves African.
The French Elves or something. You know, that's...
Well, I think that Caucasian term is phased out.
I don't know. The police will use it.
I think that we should embrace the out of Africa theory and demand Africa back. I mean, that would be a failure spiritually, of course, but it would be good for propaganda, maybe.
Well, another TV program. Wife was watching one of these property shows, and interviewing South African couple who were wanting to sell their home in outside Durban, beautiful sort of six bedroom, spread outside Durban, were going to have to move into a two bedroom house in the south of England, and. They said that they were moving out because of the crime, but the TV broadcaster he wouldn't have that. He kept saying, "Oh no, the reason you're leaving is because you want to be near your son." And they said, "No, it's the crime, it's the rape and the murders just down our street." And he argued with him and said, "No, the reason you're leaving that beautiful country, you know, where everybody, you know, black and white are dancing around." Making daisy chains and singing Kumbaya. Nelson Mandela has created this utopia, this dream rainbow land. So he argued with the couple who had been living there 30 years, and they knew exactly why they were getting out of South Africa. But
Was that a
British chap, yeah. It's one of these property shows, you know. They help the families sell and buy a suitable property. It's a bit of escapism, you know. At 11 o'clock at night, I do enjoy 10, 20 minutes relaxation. But it was awesome to watch this. He just wouldn't have... He had been fed lies that South Africa is a wonderful multicultural dream world with sun and beautiful beaches, and no one in their right mind would want to leave it. You know? But that's just a bit of, and you don't get much of it.
What surprises me is that, like, what happens in Africa, in South Africa. I mean, few people know about this, about the white farmers who are being killed. I mean,
right.
If I didn't know about, like, Christian identity, I wouldn't have known that this happened. You know, it's very...
Yeah.
No one talks about it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's never mentioned here at all.
No, it's never mentioned here, but that's, yeah, you know, it's... There's a great parallel in Bolshevik Russia, right? But where the propaganda said that the Bolsheviks had built a workman's paradise, and really we know 60 million people were being starved to death, right?
Yeah.
But, well, they can't do that so much anymore because of the internet. They can't really get away with these outright lies because now the Jewish control, even though the Jews own 95% of the mainstream media, their control on the news is no longer monolithic like it was in the years before World War II, when Americans didn't get any news from Europe unless it came through Reuters.
Yeah.
Right? So it's, they can't get away with the lies anymore, so now they just ignore it. But if it weren't for the...
To the internet, I don't know, to be accessible, just like for, you have to, I don't know, like shut down, is that true? I don't know, I hear something like that.
Well, this conspiracy theorists are always afraid they're going to shut down the internet, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you hear it, I hear it every couple of months, they're going to shut down the internet. I don't worry about it. I never fear their fear. Never be afraid of what they might do. Simply make the best use of the tools you have while you have them.
That's the best.
I think shutting down the internet would be just too much, you know, like, too obvious.
If they shut down the internet, you'll find me on ham radio.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I still my transceiver standby.
It's interesting you talk about South Africa, so it's, I wanted to talk about something. of course, New Zealand and South Africa have had a long history of close ties. And closest ties, actually, of all things, sporting, because New Zealanders and South Africans love their rugby. But back in 1981, it was very much, if you can pinpoint a time in New Zealand's history where the fulcrum turned from being a white conservative, hunt, white farmers hunting and Christian society to being a liberal society was around about 1981. And at that time, well, of course, after the 60s and 70s generation came through to being voters and community players, but at that time there was a rugby tour that South African team made in New Zealand. And, of course, there was just protesting all over New Zealand. People that wanted to stop it because of apartheid, and then supporters of it from the other side, and there was fights on the streets, there was arguments in the families, split rugby clubs. How old would I have been then? I was 10, but I was still playing rugby in the club, so I remember all that stuff. And from there on, really, New Zealand was identified, you could identify in the community a liberal element. And then in 1984, an extremely liberal government got in, and was really the old society had finished in New Zealand. Everything was sold off, privatized, as they all did at that era, and socialist, on the other side, not socialist, but the liberal views were just adopted across the board. And at the time, of course, all the Aboriginal issues came to the front, and all the lands and the forests and the assets started to be given back to the Aboriginals. So really, this relationship between New Zealand and South Africa was very close, and it was a big issue that led to New Zealand taking the path that it has for the last 30 years. And it's just a path to destruction. It's New Zealand's... It's a wonderful country. I don't think, I mean, Yahweh's world is all wonderful, but New Zealand was just an incredible natural beauty country. And Irish, Scotch, and English.
Yes, people,
mostly. People, there's not many Germans. What's that?
Over 20 years, people coming back from New Zealand to Ireland, you know, said, oh, great place, just like here. 20 years ago, but you see that's changed, you know.
Yeah.
They've
and
been
now,
targeted.
Just yeah, because it was such a small country, I think things were promoted and moved at such a fast pace, and the whole things that had taken time in Canada, such as giving assets back to the Inuits and the the immigration, it's a bigger country, Canada, but New Zealand is so small, and it just happened so quickly. And it's still, you know, there's still pure Israelites there, many of them, but they're just marrying the Maoris, and they're still...
Yes, I met some incredible New Zealanders in London who were on holiday. They were fanatic sailing enthusiasts. And
oh, yes.
The America's Cup, which was hosted from New Zealand. I think, yeah, that was about 10 years ago, wasn't it?
That's right.
And I was amazed how these two women, so knowledgeable about yacht racing, you know, and it seemed an ideal, an idyllic country. And there was lots of Brits were thinking, look, let's escape to New Zealand. You know, we can retain traditional English culture. But I think that the message, the news was getting out to the dodgy people that Zealand had to be harmonized. It had to be infected with multiculturalism pretty fast. So I'm sure it's been targeted.
I'm sure it was too. Yeah.
I have a client whose daughter is a banker, and her name is Katz. You know. And she living in New Zealand. So, I mean, obviously the New Zealand banks are probably well dominated by our Edomite friends, you know. So I guess New Zealand's been...
Well, New Zealand, it followed the America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all went bankrupt within a few days, as I understood, in the 30s. It was all within the same project.
Yeah.
So it's no different.
I have a question. Is there any bank that is not owned by Jews?
Oh, maybe in Iran, Libya, North Korea, one of those countries the Jews are trying to blow up, you know?
Yeah.
If you look at world history the last 200 years, you'll find that world history is right on the heels of monetary history. I mean... When the Tsar didn't want a central bank, the Jews destroyed Russia. But when Kaiser Wilhelm wanted to determine Germany's history and Germany's future instead of the Jews destroyed Germany. But when Adolf Hitler stood up to defend the German people from the Jews of the Weimar Republic and run them all out of town, that because all they did was to corrupt German society and Christian civilization, the Jews destroyed Germany again. In the 50s and 60s, I'm sure that America would have had a war. America would have had a war with Russia or with China if we'd have stood up for our culture and our civilization. But in the 50s and 60s, we played the whore for the Jews. We rolled over and turned our society over to Jewish ideals. And we didn't need that war because the Jews already beat us.
Well, Barclays Bank is a British bank. But it's really an international. But the propaganda is that it's owned by two close brothers in one of the small Channel Islands near France, and they're supposed to be Jesuits, and they also own the Daily Telegraph newspaper, the London Daily Telegraph, which is one of the main quality broadsheets. But of course, we know that Jesuits aren't really Catholics. You know? It's more Jesuits. I don't know any of the big banks in Britain that's owned by ordinary...
I don't think you'll find one, and they've determined world history to last at least for 100 years. I don't think... If there's no Federal Reserve, there's no First World War.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's I believe that.
Mm. Yeah.
There's no revolution in Russia either.
Right.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
It's interesting for me, in here in Ukraine, I've been here 6 years, many interesting things, of course, but one, we're talking about television, I've very much noticed in the last 3 years, in particular, the degradation of the, not that I watch much television, but of the programming on television, and because over the last 2 or 3 years, a lot of the oligarchs, again Jewish, have been buying these stations, and it's just turned it to complete garbage. When I came here, there was the Orthodox Church, such as it is, that they still had their own. They've still got their own station now, which runs 24/7. But they had a lot of just history programs and normal educational television.
Now it's just trash. Right. It's shows, it's, you know, it's girls half naked, it's all the degeneration that you'd expect from their, you know, the ownership.
Yeah, I noticed that thing in Romania too. When I was little, I don't remember the TV being like that when like now. And now it's like they put a lot of shows about the Islamic culture. I really noticed that. Uh-huh. No woman dancing in those costumes, and I said, "Wow, what's this?" You know, in many many shows. I mean, like. Everything, like every channel, is owned by a Jew.
Right.
So they turned Ukraine into an ideal. Ukraine is the ideal Jewish-controlled country now. Of course, they put a lot of work into it over the decades, didn't they? But you've got a population that's been beaten down. Still, never an excuse. Everyone can stand up on their feet, can't they? But still, history shows that they've been beaten down for generations. They've got very low wage structure. They were put to into slavery essentially to industrialize the territory, and then as soon as communism finished, the so-called period of anarchy, which is a controlled anarchy, they just passed laws that are grey to keep themselves stealing the assets. They stole the assets to themselves, and so they've got a population which they can draw on for cheap labour. They own all the assets in a few hands. They've got the Orthodox Church, which worships the Jew, Israel, modern Israel, as we know, as you know, the state of Israel, and that doesn't define Israel as we do, and does not excoriate Jew from the society as once was the history in this territory. And so it's the ideal society for the Jew.
Right, it's just like America is today. The same thing.
Yeah.
It's all the same way.
Well, the communists destroyed a lot the eastern countries. I mean, between the wars in Romania, like, it was a rich country, you know, the price of the wheat was established in Romania, you know, it was developing at an incredible pace. And then, well, you know, just the communists came and took control, and by cheating, of course, by faking the votes, and everything just fell apart.
Right.
Is Edward Shevardnadze involved with Ukraine? Or is that Belarus?
He was Georgia, right. Wasn't he?
Georgia.
Georgia, yeah.
Edward
Shevardnadze.
Shevardnadze. Yeah.
So, have you learned the Ukrainian language?
Russian.
Michael?
No.
Russian?
To my shame, I know very little Ukrainian. I know some. Because in the village, they speak a hybrid language between the two. But most Russian, yeah.
Is Russian the official language?
Well, you know, they've made such an argument about that, but no, it's not. So all legal documents have to be done in Ukrainian. They're talking about making Russian an official language again. It's a bit of a political football. Instead of putting their effort into cleaning the streets up and giving people work, they tend to argue about what language to speak. It's a secondary issue, really, isn't it?
Much but, English spoken.
No, very little. I met a French guy on the market the other day, actually. I was speaking English in the family, and we walked past, and there was a French guy selling second-hand goods on one of those local market. And he said in English, you know, do you speak English? I thought he was just another Russian. They sometimes do that, you know, try and make friends with you and then try and cheat you later. But and I met this French guy about a month ago. Since then, met him a few times. He's over here teaching French. He's a retired guy.
Okay.
And a few other business things. So there's a few foreign folk in here, but not many, no. But it's snowing in here. It's snowing again tonight.
Usually in the programs that I do with Sword Brethren, I blame too much on the French, but I don't have a guilty conscience about it.
The poor French.
Yeah.
But they have a nice language.
I can't stand their language. I'm sorry. I can't. I think it's an extremely feminine language. I don't like it at all.
I don't like it either.
I don't. Grown men shouldn't talk like that. Ooh, la la. That. Wait too many.
Other.
Yeah, right.
Do you think it's anything to do with Reuben?
Well, he was unstable, wasn't he?
Yeah, right.
And France has always been unstable.
Yeah.
So even if that connection is not there somehow, the people seem to have that characteristic.
France, I think, has been rife with political instability because of racial degeneration that's been going on since the time the Moors were in southern and central France.
Yeah.
I think France is the country most non-white people are like in France has a lot of non-white population. I think the country that has largest non-white population is France from Europe.
Definitely.
Racial reporting in the French statistics for demography. I'd say that France could easily be 30% non-white, but we wouldn't really know since they report based on nationality.
Well, I knew that. I read the statistic that 52% of babies born in Paris were black.
Oh, that could be, meanwhile.
Right.
France has the highest Muslim population in Europe.
But here, the most popular name for a baby boy at the moment is Mohammed.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Where? In England.
In England.
It's horrible.
Yeah, imagine.
Yeah. I think it's a horrible name.
Yeah.
My next door neighbor is Dan. He's got a very good job and he's fairly civilized, you know, typical. But in our neighborhood, geographical neighborhood, DNA neighborhood, biggest houses are our own.
Alan, you cut out at the last minute there. We can't quite. You're still cutting out periodically.
Right.
You said the biggest houses were owned
Biggest houses in my street are owned by Asian businessmen. Well, one of the famous 1950s Westminster parliamentary Jews, Manny Shinwell, used to live three doors down from me. He's dead. He's dead now.
Yeah.
Emmanuel Shinwell. That sounds so Christianized, you know.
Yeah, and no more. Just a cover. Yeah.
But my neighbors have stopped inviting me for dinner parties because they just want to laugh, and I'm too serious, you know?
Yeah.
So where do you go for a serious conversation nowadays, apart from TeamSpeak or TalkShoe?
Yeah.
It is a problem.
It's getting difficult. I know.
Our culture has been turned upside down, you know?
Yeah.
People used to socialize to talk, you know, about serious things. Now, serious things are excluded. You know, you have to talk about football or TV or have a laugh, you see. You've got to have a laugh.
But we're all in that predicament, Alan. I go to family gatherings here, and I'm basically standing with the women because the men are all watching the Negroes carry balls up and down fields or courts, and I won't do it.
I won't
participate.
I got 6 million laughs.
I'll talk to my female cousins, and I leave, and they don't like to talk to me either because of my religious viewpoints, and they're all Baptists, so I basically can just sit around and watch people.
Yeah.
Well, at least we can Skype each other.
Snipe at each other, did you say?
No.
Skype.
Oh, sorry, Skype.
Thank you.
It's been a bit of sniping. Snipe.
Not tonight, though, hasn't it?
It's everybody's on their best behavior.
Yeah, that's right. That's best now. We have Skype. Yeah, that's why I wonder why Chris is not there. June is with Chris,
And they are not here. Maybe they were on PIP or something like it.
I don't know. I think Chris took me off his email distribution because other people are describing emails they got from Chris that I used to get. But if that's, you know, that's their prerogative, I guess. Maybe I'm just being paranoid or something.
Well, I've never been to a football game, and I never plan to go to a single one. I don't get what's with these people. They have season tickets. They go to every single football game. They watch every game, and then they don't know the Bible, and they say they don't have time to read it.
Yeah, well, that's idolatry. They'd rather engage in the idolatry of the world than in the seeking the pleasure and the goodwill of God, right?
When I was young, I really liked baseball, though, but I got really upset when maybe I was like 12 and all these Negro players and a lot of white players, too, they were making $3-4 million a year and they were going on strike demanding that their pay be doubled. I'm thinking they're getting paid $4 million to play a game and they want more money.
Well, I hope you don't drink Coca-Cola because you know where all that money endorsement money's going, right?
Oh, no, I don't drink soda.
It's best.
I try not only do I not watch any sports or engage in any of that garbage, but I also try not to patronize companies to promote that trash.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, like instead of watching football, couldn't you yourself play football, do some sport? I mean, watching, I think it's like a bit boring and useless.
It's good to get around if you want to get around some of your kin, you know, some of your brethren, and throw a ball or play some rugby. I don't have a problem with that. You're actually engaging in exercise and doing something to have communion with your brethren. That's fine.
That's what really annoys me, that we have a lot of people that follow sports so fanatically. They have all the cards, all the jerseys, they know everything, but they don't play any sport themselves.
Yeah, well, that's idolatry. That's exactly what that is. That's why I did that program last year. I did a recitation of Tertullian's De Spectaculis with some notes. And I think it has a lot of downloads. I think it actually has a few thousand downloads. But, that's exactly why I did it, to show that that this modern sports mentality is the same bread and circuses mentality that the ancient Romans had.
They're living vicariously through others.
Well, that's part of it, but it's basically idolatry is what it is.
Yeah, it's idolatry, yeah.
Well, at least if the players were all white, you know.
Yeah. People are looking for entertainment, they're looking for excitement, and they're looking for heroes because there's no heroes in the church. There's no heroes in politics or academia, you know. So, TV and sport, the form of hero worship. Yeah. But it's exciting, and if you're not actually participating, well, you know, you're mixing with people that actually get off the sofa and exercise. So they think somehow that they can lose weight by watching football on TV.
Yeah. And they have a bunch of crunchies as a side. Yeah. And popcorn, yeah. I mustn't think about it.
Well, all of those games, not all of them, but most of those games were originally just community games. Most of them, of course, developed in Britain, football, rugby.
Yeah, right.
Cricket, you know, Ireland Gaelic football was, you know, the basis of American football, and they're only the community events. They weren't just with your mates getting together and fellowshipping in some form. They weren't professional, you know, hero worshipping, as you're saying, Alan. It was just a community event. It wasn't. I remember when, again, rugby. I remember when that went professional. That was it. I never watched the game after that. The whole culture changed.
Right.
I enjoyed playing rugby, you know, with my mates. But
yes, there used to be debates about amateur and professional status, but all that has disappeared in the last 20 years. No one ever mentions amateur sport now. You know, it's just money has taken over.
Yeah, it's big business.
I've got a footballer lives three doors down from me, and he's on £50,000 a week, £1,000 sterling a week.
For a week?
That's just madness.
Yeah.
Well, talking about sports, I would like to add that there is a Romanian gymnast. I don't know if you heard about her, Nadia Comăneci. She was the only woman in history to take like 4-10, perfect 10 in gymnastics. I mean, you can watch her performance in YouTube. She's really amazing.
She was brilliant.
She lives in America.
Yeah, she became a role model for many young gymnasts in Romania.
Good.
Yes, the gymnasts seem to come from Eastern Europe, don't they? Wonderful gymnasts.
I think that's actually because the Soviets had such a program that they invested an awful lot of money in, right, to develop those gymnasts.
It was supposed to be
especially with the gymnasts.
Well, the Olympics are supposed to be amateur. In the Soviets, rather than using amateur athletes, they would take people that were amateur athletes and they would give them a stipend and an allowance so they could train full time instead of being people that had a 9-to-5 job and then they would train on the weekends and train in the spare time. The Soviets basically put them on a salary and said, your full time job now is to train and get ready for the Olympics. So they're no longer amateurs.
Comăneci was very young, though. You know, she really.
Yeah, she was 14.
Didn't have a whole lot of time to engage in that culture, right?
Hmm.
But the Chinese are doing that same thing now. They're developing full-time athletes. They've been doing it for years.
It violates the spirit of the Olympics, doesn't it?
And wasn't it 6 years ago the Chinese swimming team?
Well, the Olympics was done as far as I was concerned. I mean, I would never really cared for it that much, but as far as I was concerned, when they let the professional American basketball players play basketball, that was it. It was commercial. It was over with.
Yeah.
What happened there? They had professionals at the Olympics.
Yeah, the American basketball players. They let all the professional basketball players play Olympic basketball.
Wow.
You know what year that was?
I don't know. It was probably in the mid to late 80s, early 90s. I forget. I don't remember.
Like that. Yeah, yeah.
It's nice to hear Sword Brethren. I've never talked to you, but I've enjoyed many of your talk shows on Weeby and the Frankfurt School and communism in Germany and Russia. You've educated me enormously, and you've a lovely accent, Sword Brethren. Thanks.
Keep
up the good work, you know.
Yeah.
Are you from out west, California? Or?
No, I'm from Ohio.
Ohio. I think I know where that is.
It's right across from Ontario on Lake Erie.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
It's a particularly nice accent, I find, anyway. Yeah.
Probably a lot better than having to listen to a New Yorker.
How's the job hunting going, Sword Brethren?
I'm still looking.
Things are pretty grim over here, too.
I'm wondering if I need to move. Since I qualify for dual citizenship with a country in Europe, I was wondering if I should exercise my option, get my passport, and move there for a while.
Yeah. That's going to happen. Yeah.
You think there's any reason to move to Italy? I mean, would anybody here want to be in Italy?
Well, as long as it's above Venice, I mean,
in the north, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've such admiration for Berlusconi. You know, he seems
it's a nice country.
A great escape artist.
Kind to the young ladies, you know.
I was just going to say, didn't he just get knocked over for
Yeah.
For dabbling or doodling or however I should term it.
Yes. Again.
Well, even though in northern Italy there are white people, I have to say I was there and there are many, many non-whites. A lot of immigration there. A lot. I was in Milan. I had a hard time spotting an Italian.
A lot of Indians there now.
Wow.
Yeah,
but where haven't you? Yeah, you know, this is the fulfillment of Jeremiah 31. There's no doubt, right? And who is exempt? Nobody's exempt. None of us are exempt from it. All the white nations.
I think Milan's the epicenter of Italian communism historically, hasn't it, Ben?
I don't know, a lot of people say that the Italian culture, the what would you say, psychology, mentality, is very similar to the Ukrainian. They have a certain flair in their personality, but on the other hand, somewhat something goes wrong, they tend to take it in a very negative way, and it can get them down probably for their whole life. So a lot of people have said that it's very similar people. It's quite interesting. Well, a lot of Ukrainians have gone to Italy actually for work. Sorry, what was that?
Sorry for interrupting you. I just said that the thing that happens in Italy is that small children are like, how you say, steal, you know, like my aunt told me that small children disappear like that, you know, and while I walked in Milan, the building had no gates, you know, like you were in prison. And you wouldn't see a kid running around because a car would just stop and steal the kid, and you would never see him again.
That could be.
Well, my aunt says that it's for organs. That's a complete mafia there. And I don't know, adoption. I don't know, Jew sacrifice. I don't know, but it's like Italians. Yeah. Many have fear of having any kids because it might be stolen.
Gypsies steal a lot of babies, from what I've been told.
Yeah, there's a lot of gypsies in Italy.
Even?
A lot of little gypsies everywhere.
Gypsies are like a traveling circus of scam artists.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are so many gypsies because, you know, woman in the gypsy culture, woman, so the parents sell the woman when she's born. So at 13 years old, the parents get the money, and the child, and the child, the woman, the little girl, has babies still that she can have, and she has like 11, 10, 15, she has many kids, and that's why they just are like rats.
Yes, Romania has a lot of problem with gypsies now.
He's sending, Iceland is sending them back to India, that's far away. It's Egypt where they have to go to. That's all. That's where they came from.
About 6 months ago, I had to spend I was catching a late train that left at about 3 in the morning from Bucharest. Yeah. And I've been around, train stations in different places in Ukraine and Russia, and they can be, you know, there's always been drunks or whatever hanging around. But so you get used to it, but for once I didn't feel safe at all there. In fact, most people ended up going into a small room that was guarded because it was cold too, because these gypsies were just circling people, approaching them, uh-huh. You know, selling them this, selling them that, then circling
right.
them, and
right.
they're just like dogs.
Yeah,
so there's a lot
yeah,
of
we just talked about gypsies in Romania because I'm from Romania.
Yeah, I guess your accent was Romanian. Are you in Bucharest?
No, I was born from northern Romania, but now
I
live in Spain. Yeah. I mean, in the south, there are many gypsies, especially in Bucharest. It's, like, full of gypsies.
Right.
There is a big difference, I noticed, between the type of people in the north and the type of people in the south.
Yeah.
Big difference. In the north, it's just...
Yeah, yeah.
Taller people, fairer. And,
completely different.
Very different.
Yeah, and there are a lot of these Germans in, from the Siebenburger Germans, was it? This is in Romania, huh? Yeah, it was in Romania. Yeah.
In Germans in Romania?
And they had their community. And Hermannsdorf. Yeah, I think it was Hermannsdorf even written that. But it's all ruined by time and it's all over. Transylvanian Saxons, yeah. Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, there were many Germans, but during communism, they kind of sent them back to Germany. But there
right.
are a few left.
Yeah, that's right. A few only left over. Some are coming back.
But most are staying back here in Europe, in somewhere in Germany. Safety. That is right.
Wasn't that part of the Morgenthau plan to kick all the Germans out of Eastern Europe in the dead of winter so millions would starve or freeze to death?
Who was supposed to be to do so?
Well, under the Morgenthau plan, that Jew that made all the deals with Stalin to destroy destroy Europe, Central Europe.
Yeah. Well, it could be. That's right.
There was a great. Well, we had discussed about the backlash against the Jews in Romania and Hungary, even before World War II broke out, and I really think that those nations were turned over to Russia so easily so that the Jews could punish them, because they almost had pogroms against the Jews before World War II broke out.
Since they said no to the Jewish racket, they brought in the Soviet muscle to put them down.
Right.
Yeah.
Russia was hard on Jews, centuries. So they copped it when they had the chance. They got them back.
Well, it ain't over.
Yeah. But the last round is going to be pretty soon. That's the real last round.
Everyone called everyone in the West knows him as Ivan the Terrible, but the actual correct interpretation is Ivan the Severe.
Right, or Ivan the Awesome, I think, even.
Grozny means severe.
Well, you kill money lenders, you're terrible.
Yeah. No, he was, severe. He was severe, all right.
Yeah, I read a Barnes Review article on him years ago that was a very good article, I thought.
Oh, here they are.
That really helped to rectify the stories told about him and to resurrect his honor, right?
He was fantastic. He defended Christendom.
Well, right. He should be a Christian icon.
Oh, is Ottilia here in the middle of the photograph?
No, there are just some photos of Romanian in folk dresses. In folk.
Yeah, right. White faces.
Yeah. They are from Maramureș, northern region.
Yeah.
Well, I put some more pictures in the Christogenea forum. I'll do a thread.
Okay.
Well, if you send me the pictures, Ottilia, I'll put them on my web space and send you back the addresses that you could use to link them, right?
Okay, you can do that.
That would make them more permanent than using Photo Bucket, and it would give you a good address to link the pictures to from anywhere, right?
Okay, I'll put some too. Okay, thanks.
I'm going to put the ones that you sent me the other day up. I just haven't done it yet.
Well, it's a bunch of girls.
What a lovely picture. What are you carrying? Is that bagels? Or is that how your bread is made?
Bread, anyway.
Yeah, that's not bagels. They're not Romanian Jews.
Well, they are some sort of traditional.
I caught you there.
Traditional, like, I don't know.
Yeah, they're lovely pictures.
Right. And the next one is having the violins in.
Where do you find these pictures?
On the link at the bottom.
In blue.
There's three links down there, Alan.
All right. Yeah. Does it open a new window?
Just right.
You can see there, I don't think you heard me. And the flicker thing, there is a picture with the gypsies. To see the difference, there's a big difference.
I was going to say, two of these girls in this third picture, they look a little Turkic to me or something.
Yeah, they who have, like, strange dresses there, the gypsies. I mean, there's a clear difference between Romanian and gypsies, as you can see.
It's clear, yeah. Definitely. It is good. Close tab. Yeah.
There are many pictures. The national costumes are really beautiful. You know, they are, like, unique.
Very similar to Ukrainian national costumes.
Yeah, they are quite related.
This is coming as... Oh, yeah.
How about this Austrian woman? How about this Austrian woman that they tried to give time to for criticizing Islam? Well, Flickr won't let me steal your picture.
Oh. You can see.
So an Austrian lady criticized Islam, and she's being put in court for that?
Yeah, she's facing 3 years. I don't think she got... Somehow she escaped the prison sentence.
Oh, Jane Burgermeister?
Yeah. This is, all right. I'm going to read this. It's from cautionamerica.com, but this has been all over the internet. I mean, there's a lot of other websites with this story.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Sabadich Wolf.
Oh?
I don't know.
And this says, ex-Nazi Austria, the Sharia Reich, 3 years in prison for criticizing Islam, and it's a question, right? Islam and Nazi, I don't agree with all this, right? Islam and Nazism are similar ideologies with similar aims and goals. This could be any one of us if we allow Obama to complete his Muslim mission here, meaning in America, right? Yeah. Elizabeth Sabadich Wolf, a brave Austrian who faces the possibility of 3 years in prison in Austria for delivering a lecture on the Islamic threat to liberty, a factual sourced lecture on the Islamic threat to liberty. And she's basically facing 3 years in prison for, here it is, Russia Today. Well, this
it's
is
always
forum.
Russia Today that brings out these interesting media reports.
Yeah.
I'm looking. Well, yeah, there's one place that cites Russia Today, but they didn't send me to Russia Today. Now, there's a couple of people talking about it. I'm looking for the actual Russia Today website right now, and I can't find it. Here it is from The Blaze. In Austria, a free speech activist has been charged with inciting religious hatred and faces 3 years in prison after criticizing Islam and Sharia law.
Oh, yeah.
Comments similar to those recently expounded by major European leaders in the UK, France, and Germany on the failures of multiculturalism. And it says Russia Today has the story, but it's a video. I'm going to post the video, but I can't play it on TeamSpeak.
Right.
We had a similar situation here a couple of years ago. Two BNP members, I've forgotten the precise situation, but they were handing out some leaflets against Islam. I think it was in Leeds. And they eventually received a 4 and a 3 year jail sentence.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, madness, huh? Yeah.
I like that Ewald Stadler. I got that video on the Saxon Messenger site. He did an excellent job with that. That Australian Minister of Parliament.
Thinking about that sword dinner, and actually, if you're moving back to Italy, I think you'll with the content of your programs. I think what's the law in Italy about revisionist law?
Right. I don't want to set foot in Europe.
You can't because of the EU laws.
Italy's all right, but yeah, of course Germany's not.
Italy's not right either because they've all signed and agreed to the EU laws as we have.
Yeah, right. So sword brethren will have to stay in the States, fortunately.
Yeah, until they make the same laws here.
yeah, you never know.
Well. I don't know. I get a kick out of the fact that my Mein Kampf site is actually hosted on a web server that's owned by a German company.
Okay. That's better. Safety first.
My brother says you can't mention Adolf Hitler in Germany. Absolutely forbidden.
If you want to mention him in context of being the most evil man ever to walk the earth.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wonder, what are these countries with all these pro-Muslim speech laws that protect the Muslims? What are they going to do when some homosexual Jew criticizes Islam for being hostile to Jews and hostile to homosexuality? Or when some feminist criticizes Islam, which sacred cow are they going to go with?
Most people don't seem to get caught up in those laws. Just like Negroes don't get charged with civil rights violations here.
No.
Because prosecutors won't prosecute the cases.
Some feminist, I think, in Norway or Sweden that said that people have to be culturally sensitive to Islam, and women have to accept that rape is a part of Islam. And
yes.
I think it's the same one that went on to talk about how she would never give birth to a white man and that she'd have an abortion if she knew she were pregnant with a boy. But I looked at her and I said, you're right, you'll never give birth to a white man because you're a Jew calling yourself a Swede.
Yeah, horrible, but it is so. Yeah.
But you would think that kind of rhetoric, that seems to me to be hate speech, saying that women have to accept rape. I think that's hate speech.
Imagine.
Mm. It's absolutely hate speech.
Yeah.
If rape is part of Islamic culture, then they should go home and practice it, right?
Right, yeah. They better stay home forever.
It's the hypocrisy of liberalism.
Sure.
Yes.
But which is the same hypocrisy of Talmudism, right?
It all is one and the same, yeah, that's right.
Well, I was actually it's a video about Stephen the Great when they defeated a very big Ottoman army. And it's a really nice speech. When you have time, you can watch it. It was like 20,000 Romanians versus, 100,000 Turks, if I'm right.
Okay.
They use tactics, you know, they use, they use the land, they use swamp, they made it in such a way that they would have no food, you know, this is how they could defeat them, because they were, just a little, just a few.
I'll see to put it in the storage.
Well, our ancestors fought a lot against the Islam and the Ottomans. And then it's so strange that now we just welcome them in Europe.
Yes, it is. They just walk in now and take over. And it was only...
They gave their lives, you know, there, so that now we can welcome them.
They don't need swords to get into Europe anymore. They just come in openly.
And it was only 300 years ago they had Vienna under siege.
Yeah.
And now they've taken Vienna without shot being fired.
Right.
Yeah, I was in the back. Stayed in again, I was in Vienna that long ago. My goodness, on the back streets, it's just all Turkish. In the center, of course, is tourists and... But in the back streets, it's Turkish.
Yeah, we've just surrendered to them voluntarily.
Yeah.
It's the, I know we don't have to like it, but it's the perfection of the Word of God. What we were told this is going to happen, and we're told that He's going to destroy our enemies or His enemies from amongst us. And if we believe it, we see it happen, so we have to believe it's going to unhappen. We have to believe that we're going to be delivered out of this as effectively as the Word told us that we were going to be put into this situation.
Put into it.
I have no doubt that we're going to prevail.
Yeah.
It's just sad to see millions of lives ruined in the process.
Well, right, it is. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, those lives aren't the life that counts either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sad to see this happen to our people. It's sad to see so many of our daughters and our sons taken off by these animals. But that's part of the lesson that our race has to learn, that only God is sovereign and only Yahweh could be our king.
Yes.
Yeah.
Our ancestors taught us this lesson.
And this doesn't have to be this way. This is simply the natural consequence of several centuries of very poor decisions that we've made.
Well, right. It's the natural consequence of embracing the enemies of God. We've embraced the Jews.
Right.
But we're calling Satan God's chosen people.
Yeah, imagine. It is so.
What could be more blasphemous than that?
Sorry, I was wrong. There are 40,000 Romanians.
40,000.
Yeah, sorry.
2.5.
That's okay.
Still 2.5. That's all right. Yeah.
I remember things screwed up all the time.
Yeah.
Well, the base, no one knows for certain how many there were, but anyway, there were a lot less, you know, the base are
Paul Ramses Rennie, President of Iceland. Okay. Yeah.
I'm going to say goodnight to everybody.
Okay, Dorcas, it's been lovely having you, and thank you, and may Yahweh bless you. Good night.
Bye,
Dorcas.
Thank you.
Have a good rest.
Okay, we can't be running out of steam already, are we? I mean, I know it's getting late over there, but...
Yeah.
Well, it's 10:30 here.
I guess 3.5 hours is enough. And I want to thank everybody for being here, and God bless you all.
And thank you.
Third of March.
Yes, I'll see you the first Thursday in March, whatever date that is.
The third. The number
wonderful.
Three. Okay. Yeah, I'll write it down here. Keep track on it to make sure I'm not missing it.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.